Today is Today is Friday, April 5th, 2013. Today is our second public hearing on House Bill 3194. For those of you who were here Wednesday, we had a very good hearing, in part because witnesses were respectful and adhered to the three-minute time limit that we are imposing here so that we have a chance to get through everybody who wishes to speak. So I will ask you again, as you come forward, we'll have a clock here. You'll see a warning light when we get down close to 3 minutes. At the three-minute mark, I don't want to cut you off mid-sentence, but please wrap up what you're saying because you will be cutting into someone else's time. We will start today's testimony with Sheriff Jason Myers and Sheriff Dan Staten, so please come forward.
Co-chairs Winters and Garrett, members of the special committee. For the purpose of the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff. I'm also the president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and a member of the Governor's Commission on Public Safety. Seated next to me is Sheriff Dan Staten, Multnomah County Sheriff. Between the two of us, we probably have about 50 years experience in public safety. I started at my career at the Sheriff's Office as a cadet and worked my way entirely up through the ranks to the office that I hold today as Sheriff. And I've had oversight of a number of different functions within our office, not just law enforcement, but corrections, community corrections, and providing services through court services and civil as well. As I just mentioned, I was on the commission that worked diligently to look at our system and come up with some recommendations around public safety. And ultimately, the bill that you're looking at now, 3194, the one we're testifying on today, is a result of that work. The Sheriff's Association is in opposition of that bill. And as I mentioned in my closing statement on the commission, I was very conflicted about the product that we created. I believe that there's aspects of this bill that, if properly funded and implemented, would be and could produce strong, evidence-based public policy. That being said, I want to emphasize that the sheriffs, and I'm also representing the Chiefs Association, have not and will not advocate these policy changes because they save money or help us to prevent building an Oregon prison. As peace officers, we do not support policy changes based solely on saving money or to balance budgets. Rather, as sheriffs and chiefs, we want to reduce crime, we want to reduce recidivism because it makes our community safer. Front-end community-based and evidence-based corrections policies are good for Oregon, and they're good for our community, but we don't want to do that at the cost of our system. Public safety reform, we believe, should be driven by thoughtful policy and not just based on savings alone. It's very important for me to be clear to the committee on this point. We believe in a strong, adequately funded criminal justice system. We are also very concerned of the decline in funding for community corrections over the last 4 years. And we stand firm in our belief that evidence-based community corrections programs are not being fully funded with a long-term commitment by the state. And that if they aren't, they won't result in the expectations that the citizens of Oregon deserve. As a sheriff who is responsible for community corrections, I've seen firsthand how evidence-based practices and the balance of supervision, sanctions, and service and services can truly save lives and make our community safer. There are also aspects of 3194 that cause sheriffs and police chiefs a great deal of concern and that we know will not make good public safety policy. The professional public safety community, including sheriffs, chiefs, and district attorneys, have an have been unwaveringly direct from day one that the commission's work that we will not support any reforms which substantially impact the very successful mandatory minimum sentencing established by ballot measures 11 and 57. These mandatory minimum sentences have worked exactly as they were intended. They put the most dangerous offenders behind bars for the appropriate period of time. Although we're not in the belief that these mandatory minimum sentences provide a perfect solution to crime, we do believe Measures 11 and Measure 57 are reflective of our state's desire to hold accountable and incapacitate those who commit the most serious crimes within our communities. We understand that making substantial changes to Measure 11 and Measure 57, which are embodied in House Bill 3194, may save the state of Oregon a lot of money. But the cost to our community's safety is just too high of a price to pay for these expected savings. As the members of this Joint Public Safety Committee and the Public Safety Subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means Committee continue to work on these important decisions, please know that your elected sheriffs, your chiefs of police will continue to be at the table working with you side by side until we can create a product that solves our state's financial crisis without creating future public safety crises. Oregon has one of the best correction systems in the nation, and I want to repeat that. We have one of the best correction systems in the nation, and I know that we all share the same commitment of the ongoing strengths of continuing to build on that. Thank you.
Chair.
Co-chair. Chairs.
Representatives from Multnomah County and also representing OSSA, I'm not going to belabor this. I believe that Sheriff Myers has indicated the position of all of the sheriffs in the state of Oregon, and I'm here to support.
I need your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Sheriff Dan Staten. I'm here to support the sheriffs of OSSA, but also to echo some concerns that we have in Multnomah County, and that is revolving around Measure 11 and some of the alternative approaches that could be utilized to improve this bill. And I'm not going to go any further than that, other than to refer back to what Sheriff Myers has said, and you've got a host of people that are here to present. I want to thank you.
Thank you. Sheriff, it was a pleasure working with you on the commission. Understand your position, your association's position on Measure 11. Could you speak to the earned time provision in the bill and what the association's position is on that?
I think if Measure 11 and the Measure 57 provisions were removed from this bill, we would be willing to talk about that.
Okay. Other questions?
Jason, you say talk about it. I mean, you were part of the commission. You worked through this process. I guess I'm trying to figure out, and Dan, you've also alluded to other measures. Can you tell us what your organization, your association is actually thinking is a way that we can actually maintain what our goals are, which is really return more money back to the community for reentry programs, for means of actually fortifying what your work has been done here in Marin County. And let's just start with that.
Yeah. We believe that any of the incentive-based programs, the ones that we took a look at on the commission, would be good ways to do that. Any program that would reduce recidivism, any program that might be able to mitigate prison entries, at the local basis, as long as the county has the capacity and it is properly funded, we support that. I think the commission results that the Pew brought forward shows that our local communities can do the job, and they can do the job very well of protecting our communities and reducing recidivism, but it has to be funded. And I think that's one of the issues that's been difficult for counties, is that as we've been in this crisis, we've seen that funding back out, yet the work hasn't gone away. So we think those are avenues. There are other avenues in 3194 that we would be willing to talk about, and we did discuss during the commission process, but we see the barrier being around Measure 11 and Measure 57. If they're in there, that's the difficulty for us, because we don't believe that would be good public policy to have those changes contained within this bill.
Follow up. Because you were on the commission, you have a lot more, let's say, insight than many, even our committee members, for the number of months that we were working together on these. the information that was brought forward to us shows in other states that they have, in fact, been able to take individuals that would fit within the criteria of those three crimes under Measure 11, as well as the ones that are in Measure 57, and actually divert them out and actually get a better outcome for the communities, which returns less recidivism, which means less victims, more gainful, let's say, opportunities for them to actually be a participant within the community in a positive way. I'm trying to figure out where the association, and I can understand some of your colleagues who may not have been there where you were and seeing the evidence on the best practices and how that actually resulted in those outcomes that Marion County has been striving and actually showing themselves, how we, how do we walk away from that evidence-based information that we've received?
Well, I would like to set Measure 11 aside because we, in Marion County, we're doing no programs around diversion of Measure 11. I think it's an effective tool, and I'm not aware of any program in the state that does a diversion around Measure 11 offenders. Measure 57 offenders, we do have a program in Marion County that we evaluate individuals, but that doesn't mean every individual shouldn't go to prison. We send people to prison. There are people that need to go to prison, but there's also people that can be worked with in the local community, and we've shown a model that adequately does a good job of identifying the right offender and sending them to the right location and keeping our community safe while reducing recidivism. So those programs are the ones that I think we could take a look at in the incentive piece if the community has the capacity and it's funded properly.
So if I can follow up.
Yes.
So regarding Measure 57, you realize from your work on the commission, we're not saying these individuals would not be going to prison. What we actually are saying, we're going to give a sliding scale. I believe it's 19 to 24 or 25 months. And we're going to allow the court to have the discretion, which was taken away back in 1995, to determine on a case-by-case basis. And so I want to make sure the record's clear that we're not saying these individuals wouldn't be going, but we're giving latitude, just like the three on Measure 11, as to putting discretion back in. And I assume what you do in your programs and what has happened in Marion County is that you're looking at each of them on an individual basis, determining what their needs are and assessing them into the appropriate programs and giving them that opportunity to, let's say, move out of the life of crime and one that actually returns them to be a better citizen and from my perspective as a victim, cut down on victimization.
Yeah, and I would add additionally, our program does do that. There is accountability in that piece too, because I think that's an important part of the whole process. But that is one thing that we have implemented in Marion County, and it has been working effectively to do that.
So if I can follow up again, one more.
One more, and then we should probably move on.
So regarding the association itself, because do you think they understood that this was not, because based on your testimony, it seems like there is a belief that these individuals would not even be going to prison as compared to going in for maybe a four-month shorter period of time?
We've thoroughly discussed both of these aspects around Measure 11 and Measure 57. And we believe that they are effective the way that they are. And despite all the conversations we've had around that and looking at it from different angles, it is the will of the voter, and we agree with them, and they work appropriately.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. Sheriff, thank you both for being here. Our next panel will be Carla Peluso, Vanessa Timmons, and Scott Taylor. And then on deck will be Katie Suver, Paige Clarkson, and Doug Harkle Road. You'll be following this group. Whatever order you like, please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Carla Peluso. I am the retired police chief of the Gresham Police Department, where I served for a total of 30 years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am here to testify in support of House Bill 3194. While I have been retired for 4 years, I remain active in my community and continue to support and work for making our region safe and healthy. I currently serve as a director on the Gresham Barlow School Board, am chair of the Multnomah County's Commission on Children, Families, and Community, and am president of the Board of Human Solutions, whose mission is to help families build pathways out of poverty, and was, this past fall, a member of the governor's 10-year budget funding team focusing on public safety. I chose to come to Salem today and testify before you because I believe in the work you are doing to find additional resources to bring to local law enforcement, drug courts, and community corrections. The modest reforms you have identified for Measure 11 and Measure 57 are smart policy choices. I am tough on crime, and I believe in holding people accountable for the crimes they commit and fully recognize the need to send people to prison and jail when they commit crimes. That was a major focus of my professional life for 30 years. I also saw the need to have resources and supports available for individuals leaving the prison system so that they would not return. I strongly believe our dollars are best invested on prevention and local intervention to assist those people in returning to society as productive members of our communities. These are the areas where the budgets have been in steady decline. Prevention and intervention are an essential part of our public safety system, and they are key factors in breaking the cycle of criminality and the cycle of violence. It takes courage to make the changes we need to our public safety system, and I commend you all for your work. Okay. Figuring out where to best put our system's resources is tricky work. The investment requires more than just policy changes. Local politics can at times create barriers to a new way of doing business, which can lead to cost savings. In 2003, as the Gresham Police Chief, working in partnership with our neighboring city police departments, we were able to engage the collective political will to form the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team. Crime and those who commit crime don't stop at city borders. We needed to consolidate our resources to address gang behavior and the crimes associated with that behavior. We came together to do that work, which allowed this multi-agency gang team to address those gang issues in a proactive, preventative way. Did we still arrest gang members? You bet we did. Did we bring education on ways to recognize early signs of potential gang influence in our schools and communities? Yes, we did. Do I believe this prevented crime? Yes, I do. Was this a cost-saving investment? Yes, it was. With the bulk of gang-related calls being handled by the East Metro Gang Enforcement Teams, patrol officers were now able to focus on the calls for service in their respective communities. This allowed for proactive patrol, quicker response times to calls, as well as time to be visible within their communities. This truly stretched each dollar to the max. Drug courts and our local community corrections offices are a first point of intervention for people who are on the cusp of going deeper into crime. I'm a big fan of the flexibility of drug courts and what community courts offer to that population of people to become successful. It is critical that when we hold people accountable for their crimes by restricting their freedom through jail, prison, or probation, ensuring that they pay restitution to victims and more, so that we can also do what we can to make sure those people don't commit crimes in the future. Our drug courts are a great vehicle for that important work.
I need to start to have this wrapped up. Thank you.
A great vehicle for that important work, and they have seen persistent cuts in funding. This is not good public safety. We have become too punitive as a society, and it is not what works best for public safety. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Timmons. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. So thanks for having me here. The Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence advocates on behalf of 50-plus tribal and community-based nonprofit domestic and sexual violence programs. We support your local programs by providing technical assistance, community education, training and prevention, and supporting coordinated emergency medical and legal response to these very extremely personal crimes. Domestic and sexual violence services are critically underfunded in Oregon. Combined state and federal funding gives programs less than half of what is needed, recommended to provide basic minimal core services. In 2011, there were over 20,000 requests for services for emergency shelter that went unmet. And that's an average of 2 unmet requests every hour of every day of the entire year. The terrifying truth is that nearly half of these requests came from victims who were also seeking safety for their minor children. I personally have sat with victims as they process the very difficult choices between personal safety and a safe place to sleep, and no one should have to make that decision. I am here today to ask you to join the Oregon Coalition in supporting House Bill 3194. When it comes to public safety, one size does not fit all. That is one reason why less than half of the domestic and sexual violence survivors do not report the crime to police. Yet more than half of Oregon's public safety resources are spent on corrections, squeezing important resources for victim services. Across the country, intimate partner violence advocates have long been concerned that a victim might genuinely fear that reporting abuse could lead to more abuse or even worse. The coalition joins many local, state, tribal, and national victim advocacy organizations to oppose mandatory minimum sentences, especially in domestic and sexual violence offenses. These one-size-fits-all sentences can have unintended consequences, that serve to decrease rather than increase public safety. They don't allow judges to consider the very specific and unique personal needs and impacts on survivors and their families. They make it less likely that the victim will report the crime to law enforcement, and it increases plea deals down to a lesser crime. Putting more money into prisons, further unbalancing resources available to the important parts of the public safety system. We at OCASVA are very fortunate to be in a position where we can represent Oregon survivors and the domestic and sexual violence services services in support of House Bill 3194. But not all domestic and sexual violence programs are in a position that they can publicly support these modifications because they have close and important, very important working relationships with their county district attorneys. Like you, victim advocates can get pressed by DAs, but we feel that the continued responsibility to speak out and be a voice for them, as you do for your constituents. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Taylor.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the president of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and I'm here today with the message that we are in support of 3194. And in addition to my role as president of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, I'm also the president of the American Probation and Parole Association, and I served on the commission. And so I understand the degree of information that was loaded upon you, the struggles you get to go through. I have over 40 years in this business, and I've been doing it in a variety of places throughout the state. And so I come to this meeting very excited that we are having a very serious discussion about the correction system, and we're having a very serious discussion about the role community corrections and the community can play in resolving this issue. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the details because my colleagues and other folks have spent quite a bit of time doing that. I did want to say that 3194 represents a major step forward in Oregon. It's been over 20 years since we've had a serious discussion about this. I was the assistant director of the Oregon Department of Corrections in charge of implementing Senate Bill 1145. And that was hard work. We did it. And we delivered on a variety of the partnership promises that were laid out in there. When we started that, we had 1,600 folks in prison beds. After the change in Senate Bill 1145, we now have 600 of those folks that serve less than a year, and we keep them locally. That's 1,000 beds every biennium you do not have to have a prison for. We delivered on that. There may be squabbles about the right amount or was the funding correct, but the counties met that challenge, and we delivered. When you look at our probation and parole recidivism rates, we are at the lowest we've been. We're down in the 18% on probation. We're in the 20% on parole. That means that when you measure it, we're getting the job done. And we're very excited that you're discussing our opportunity to do that again. As I listened to the testimony the other day, and I've listened before, we've talked about how 75% of the people may not go to prison, 25% do. One of my points today is that I get to supervise all of them. When the 75% do not go to prison, they remain in the community and we supervise them. When the 25% who range in the full range of crimes that you sent to prison come out, we get to supervise them. And if we do not find So 94% of those people, 13,000 a year, come onto our rolls. If we do not have the opportunity to manage them, it will be sad. I gave you this chart. I'm running out of time. I'll just say that we did a real quick survey locally of all 36 counties, 29 responded, and that gives you some idea where they, off the top of their heads, from what they're experiencing in cuts and chops that you've heard about, would invest the money. And we think that since Senate Bill 1145 passed, we've had 20 years of research on what works. We think that the work you're talking about, the details in the bill, all do that. And we are ready to go to work and make this happen for you. So please, any questions?
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, all three of you, for being here. Katie Suver and Doug Harkleroad and John Foote, please.
They want to go get them.
Ready? He's outside.
Yeah, I think they. I just want. I think he just wanted to get them. Let's do it.
Co-chairs, Co-chair Garrett for the day, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Harkleroad. I want to tell you just a bit about myself. I was the district attorney in Lane County for about 24 years, six elections worth. In 1986, the second day in office, I started a victim services program. In the early 90s, I started a child advocacy center called Kids First Now. I was the president of that nonprofit for 10 years. Senator Prozanski, I believe, still sits on that board of directors. I was a founding member of the Domestic Violence Council, created early disposition programs for all kinds of offenders in Lane County, working in conjunction with Ross Shepard, the retired public defender. The psychiatric hospital was actually attached to our jail and run by our local hospital for 19 years before it was cut. I was one of the leaders of that movement to get that hospital open. We have a drug court in Lane County. It still runs today. Judge Larson was the spear of the point. Anybody who knows about drug courts knows they don't run if you don't have a district attorney who's willing to participate and screen people into those. For the last 4 years, I've been trying to get the Oregon State Legislature to fund reentry programs that you've heard these people talking about, both on last Monday and again today, because that will reduce recidivism. The simple fact of the matter is if you properly fund those programs, you only have to stop somewhere between 19 and 30 offenders a month from going to prison. You have a big population of people out on supervision. And I believe Mr. Taylor can do that, along with everybody else in the state. And you don't have to cut these sentences at all. That will work. It is a solution, and you will save the money. All right. My clients and I personally are opposed to shortening the sentence for person crimes, those ones you know about. We're also opposed to shortening the sentence for those repeat property offenders, those in measure 57, aggravated theft, burglary, identity theft, just so on and so forth. We're also personally, I'm also personally, as well as my clients, opposed to early releases that are excessive. Right now we have 20%, 30% for a few people temporarily. And we're opposed to the transitional leave as designed in this bill and the excessive alternative incarceration program. I don't want to talk, I could talk a long time about all this. By the way, I attended every commission meeting for the first commission, and I only missed one on the second commission. I have a pretty good attendance record. I was there with all of you, who, and you all know that. I'm at the yellow stage. When I thought about what could I argue about Measure 57, I went back and I found the legislative argument and support in the voters' pamphlet signed by Senator Prozanski, Representative Olson, Representative McPherson. It's a powerful argument for this measure. I will leave you with that copy and copies of that. Regarding earned time, I'm going to leave you another item for earned time. And my offer to you is give us the top 50 assault twos, the top 50 robbery twos, and the top 50 sex abuse one cases that are currently in the penitentiary by name and by county, and we will tell you who those people are and why they went there. I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Katie Suver. I'm with the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I'm here on behalf of them as well as the Oregon District Attorney's Association. And I'm here to talk about a couple of cases specifically, and specifically related to this bill's efforts and decision to remove sexual abuse in the first degree as a ballot measure 11 offense, and to try to convince you why that is wrong. As a child abuse prosecutor, obviously, we see hundreds of these types of cases every single year. Just last week, however, I appeared in court in a case involving a defendant by the name of Craig Jensen, who was 53 years old, and aside from one prior arrest for DUI, I had no criminal history. But he had sexually abused his 8- and 9-year-old granddaughters. And his 9-year-old granddaughter described how he had taken her into his room, and he undressed her. And he touched her vaginal area with his bare hand while masturbating himself. Now, those weren't the words she used, but she described how his hand was on her his penis while he was touching her. And then he told her that he wanted her to touch his penis. And when she did so, she told the child abuse investigator how he peed on her hand. I want that to be uncomfortable for you to hear, because that is sexual abuse in the first degree. And if you remove that crime from ballot measure 11, someone like Craig Jensen, who sexually abused his own granddaughters, a 9-year-old little girl, is not going to go to prison, and in fact could get probation, because sexual abuse in the first degree is a crime seriousness 8 on the sentencing guidelines. And what he would be is effectively an H. So the presumptive sentence might be 19 to 20 months in prison, but he can also get probation. And ladies and gentlemen, as I mentioned, he also sexually abused his 8-year-old granddaughter as well. And this didn't just happen one time. It happened more than once. What we're talking about with sexual abuse in the first degree are child molesters, people who harm children. And as a matter of public policy, as a mother, as a citizen of the state of Oregon, if we're not willing to step up and protect children, our most vulnerable members of society, then we shouldn't be in this business. The second and last case I want to talk to you about happened on Monday, and I'm sure anyone who has listened to the news or read the newspaper lately knows about this one. Father Angel Armando Perez was sentenced to 75 months in prison under ballot measure 11 because a young boy who was a member of his parish, who had been an altar boy, whose family he had befriended, was sexually abused by him, and that young boy had the courage to run down the street and ask for help. And without Measure 11, that defendant probably would not be in prison. Thank you.
Mr. Foote, Commissioner
Foote. Good afternoon. Fellow Commissioner Garrett, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. We are all public servants in our business, and
I need your name for the record.
Oh, John Foote, I'm sorry. And you know my background. I've been on the commission with many of you, and I've testified in front of you before, so I won't belabor it. I only have 3 minutes. What's one of the most troubling things about us in this business is this, there's this, just this feeling that the way things really work is not the way this has been done. I encourage all of you to go to your DA's offices and see how these cases are handled. The information you've been given through this process by Pew is misleading. It's not real. And that's why we're here. The victims of these crimes will be domestic violence victims and children. That's who you're talking about on Measure 11. And the people you're talking about in 57 are people who are doing tremendous damage in the community. All the others aren't in prison. We're doing the things you want. The system works the way you say you want it to, but it's been portrayed differently. That's the first thing. The second thing is we want to help you find solutions that save money. But sentencing, Community Corrections has sort of gotten in the game about what should be happening at sentencing. They don't do sentencing. I told Colette Peters, who's a good person and a good director, you don't do sentencing. Colette, you don't understand the dynamics of sentencing. It's not just about fixing the defendant. It's about justice on serious cases, and the vast majority of these people don't go to prison. If you count the misdemeanors, it's 90%. It's about justice. And that's why these cases call out to you. It's not just about a sentence that fixes somebody or... And we've worked so hard to make it better in the last 25 years. It is better. Violent crime is down. We have tools to deal with repeat property criminals. Please don't take these away from us with a portrayal of our system that is not accurate. It is not what is really going on. Finally, the way victims have been sort of excluded from this conversation, except through providers, nonprofits who provide services to victims, who have been the people solicited in this process. They want the money, right? They're in front of you for the money. Where are the victims? Dee Dee Coons is sitting back here, probably the champion of victim rights in Oregon. I invited her to come. Let's hear about the victims, not the people who are providing the services, who are in here because they want you to give them the money. But they're not telling the victims of these crimes that it will come from reduced sentences from the people that have hurt them. That just doesn't seem right to me. So you can tell the passion in my voice. This has been a very difficult process because of these things, and disturbing, because we are not doing what you have been told we are doing, and we can help you solve these problems like we always have. We helped you do 57, which stopped 61, which had mandatory minimums in it. So please take a step back from this and help us find solutions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the panel?
Yes.
Senator Przanski.
Katie, in your position, the story that you gave us, the example with the grandchildren, in your time, and I assume here in Marion County, have you ever seen a judge actually give, in that type of fact scenario, only probation and not actually require them to go to prison?
Under Measure 11, a judge would not have the authority to do so.
I understand that, but prior to that, I assume you were practicing then.
I was. Senator Przanski, I was.
Fortunately, yeah, Senator Przanski, I must look older than I actually am. I became
mature.
So after Measure 11 had
okay. Thank you.
So.
Thank you.
Can I answer just for the record? I did prosecute cases before sentencing guidelines. I ran a sex crimes unit in Portland in the 80s, and people did these crimes, did get probation, not infrequently, because they come in and they look like everybody's dad and everybody's brother and everybody's neighbor. And they have a sex offender therapist who says they can fix them. We've seen this happen. And that priest would make a pretty good show in front of a judge. That's what happens in sentencing.
I wasn't speaking about the priest.
I know, but I mean the father. I mean, it's just what happens.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Our next panel is David Van Spaybrek, Bernie Bottomley, and Suzanne Hayden.
Mature.
Okay. And then we're going to have some telephonic testimony after that. He's here. She's fine.
Chair Garrett, co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is David Van Spaybrek. I'm a partner in the law firm of Sussman Shank and a member of the Portland Business Alliance. I'm a trial attorney. I do civil cases. I don't do criminal cases. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of House Bill 3194. We in the legal and business community appreciate your efforts to tackle this difficult issue of improving our criminal justice system and doing it within the equally difficult framework of politics, public perception, and limited budgets. Fortunately, we have the comprehensive work of the Oregon Commission on Public Safety to turn to for guidance in this effort. The Commission's dispassionate, data-driven approach to its recommendations provides a firm foundation from which to make these important adjustments to sentencing and corrections policies. The recommendations of that report, which are reflected in House Bill 3194, are based on sound, proven principles to control prison growth, hold offenders accountable, and protect public safety. In a world of limited resources and options, this legislation refocuses policies to ensure there is adequate prison resources available to incarcerate the most serious violent offenders and redirect savings from the controlled prison growth to investments in community resources like law enforcement, community supervision, drug treatment, and transition services where they are most effective in reducing recidivism, reducing victimization, and protecting public safety. House Bill 3194 is not about going easy on offenders. It is about using evidence-based approaches to match the appropriate public safety tool to the crime and the criminal. It's not really about saving money, although we hope that by being intentional in our case and our use of the available tools, we will be more efficient. What this effort is about is improving outcomes for the entire public safety system. Fewer crimes, less recidivism, fewer victims, and a safer, more productive society. One of the things I have the pleasure of doing in my career is working with our Oregon judges, and we are very blessed with a very deep, talented bench in this state. They make smart decisions. They're not perfect, but they are very, very good, and I like that this bill gives more discretion to them. I think that's something that this committee needs to strongly consider. They are a resource, and we should use them. We understand that issues of this type are complex and fraught with emotion and can be difficult to address in the world of the five-minute news cycle. But we need to be led by the data and experience of other states and jurisdictions that have shown the efficacy of these approaches. We in the business community support these evidence-based approaches and stand ready to work with you and the governor to communicate the need to adopt these strategies to improve community safety and obtain the best return on our public safety investments. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, co-chairs, and members of the committee. Thank you for all your work on this issue and giving me the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Suzanne Hayden. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Crime Commission, and the majority of my professional career has been spent as a Multnomah County District Attorney from 1992 to 2010. I'm here representing the companies and the individuals that make up the Crime Commission, and we are here in support of the Oregon Public Safety Package contained in House Bill 3194. The work of the Governor's Public Safety Commission, which many of you served on, was an unprecedented, comprehensive evaluation of our state's policies, practices, and trends in the use of prison and other corrections programs. The benefit of this examination resulted in a report that highlights the strengths of our public safety system, and we should feel proud about that. But it also highlighted the areas that we need to adjust and make changes in our investments. The other benefit of the public examination is that we have an incredible capability now with technology and data analysis that was not available in the past. This means that you and the public can view all of the data and circumstances of our counties across the state and compare them to each other. The unmistakable trend in how we use our prison beds indicate we are increasingly using prison for nonviolent and property offenders. With projections in prison growth based on current laws, policies, and practices, we will exceed our capacity and need to build more capacity in the next decade, which is projected to exceed the price tag of $600 million. Is that where we should invest our public dollars for the best public safety outcomes? You've heard from counties across the state. They're struggling to adequately fund community corrections, police, victim services, reentry programs, and treatment for addiction and mental health issues that do feed criminal behavior. This has been a slow but steady shift in public investments away from evidence-based efforts that reduce recidivism towards increasing our prison population and capacity. And we're at a decision point in our state which requires leadership to correct that trend. House Bill 3194 does not contain dramatic changes in sentencing or corrections policies. The elements are based on data and research, and we believe the changes will improve the way we do business and provides a plan to use public safety dollars more intentionally to achieve better public safety outcomes and better oversight for those outcomes. It allows communities to decide how to best invest state grants
for their communities to improve public safety and recognizes their efforts to optimize their use of prison space. And we believe 3194 continues to hold offenders accountable, achieves justice, and gets the best return on the state's public safety dollars. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Mr. Bottomley.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Bernie Bottomley. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs and Economic Development at the Portland Business Alliance. The alliance is made up of about 1,300 small, medium, and large businesses in the greater Portland area. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 3194. The alliance is a strong supporter of effective and robust public safety investments. As you can imagine, our members and their employees benefit from safe communities, and that provides a critical foundation for a successful business environment. They understand both the human and financial costs of underinvesting in our public safety system. But we're also business people who understand the need for data-driven decision-making and a focus on continuous improvement, doing what works to achieve the outcomes that we need. The work of the Governor's Public Safety Commission embodies those same values. Their report to the Governor shows that Oregon has been doing relatively well in reducing crime over the past few decades, but that the trends are not optimistic, that we're moving in the wrong direction, and will shortly require the addition of a new state prison with a significant cost to the public and the taxpayers. It's prudent, in faced with that kind of expenditure, to examine whether there are effective alternatives that are both effective and can be had at a better cost. By using a data-driven approach, Public Safety Commission's report provides a roadmap for alternatives that accomplish those twin goals of effectiveness and reduced cost. To be clear, the business community wants to hold people who commit crimes accountable for their actions. For sanctions to be effective as a deterrent, they must be swift and certain, and there must be resources devoted to ensuring appropriate sanctions are available. That said, our experience in Portland shows the use of sanctions are most effective when paired with alternatives and programs that help address the root causes of much of that criminal behavior, drug and alcohol abuse, mental illness, unemployment, and poor education. We believe there's an opportunity in this instance to adjust the direction of Oregon's correction system in such a way as to avert the need for additional prison beds, maintain accountability for offenders, and have better public safety outcomes by investing those cost savings into proven and effective programs, such as additional police, community corrections, addiction and mental health treatment and reentry programs. We can achieve the best outcomes as well as the best return on the public safety dollar. We support the recommendations for those adjustments in sentencing and corrections policy made by the Public Safety Commission and contained in this legislation. We urge your favorable vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel? And thank you again for being here. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Bob Herman, please. Yeah, and after Mr. Herman goes, we're going to take some testimony by telephone, but why don't we go ahead and have you proceed?
Thank you, Chair Garrett. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I've been asked today and had the privilege to perhaps introduce Marnie Leavenworth, who will be testifying over the phone.
Would you rather I get her on the phone so you can introduce her?
Yeah, if you don't mind, yeah, okay. So she can hear what I have
to
say.
I didn't realize that. We'll do that. Ms. Leavenworth?
Hi.
Hi, this is Chris Garrett with the Oregon Legislative Joint Committee on Public Safety. We're calling for your testimony on House Bill 3194.
Okay.
Mr. Herman, if it's okay with you, was going to offer some testimony, and then you'll have your opportunity.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Herman, go ahead.
Thank you. Again, Bob Herman, District Attorney for Washington County, and Ms. Leavenworth has dealt with another prosecutor in our office who actually handled her case, and then a senior deputy, Bracken McKee, who helped coordinate her testimony, so neither one of them could be here today. But by way of introduction, Ms. Leavenworth has agreed to testify, and I believe she had an opportunity to hear some of the testimony Wednesday. And she's the victim of a number of sexual assaults. As it happens, her case just ended in Washington County about 3 weeks ago. In the second day of trial, the defendant decided to change his plea to guilty to all the charges, and the judge, in his or her discretion, imposed a 210-month sentence, exceeding the Measure 11 mandatories by making them consecutive based upon view of the conduct that occurred in this case. And as Ms. Leavenworth will tell you, she is the what I would describe as the victim of an example of what pre-Measure 11 sentences were like, when an individual could get 16 to 18 months in prison and then be supervised under post-prison supervision and go on to commit significant crimes that resulted in additional victims. So with that, I thank Ms. Leavenworth for being willing to come and talk, and I would turn it over to her.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. All right, Ms. Leavenworth, if you're ready to give your testimony, we're ready to listen.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As Mr. Herman said, I was sexually and mentally perpetrated upon as a child.
I'm sorry. I need you to state your name for the record, please.
Oh, my name is Marnie Leavenworth.
Thank you.
Just last month in the state of Oregon, I was able to put my perpetrator in prison for sexual abuse in the first degree under Measure 11 for 220 months. I'll try to keep what I have to say brief. So my parents were divorced in 1995 when I was 8 years old, and my mother moved away with me and my brother, who's 3 years older than me, so she was a single mother. And I also have a brother who's 14 years older than me, and he had a friend who went away to prison for a drug charge, and his name was Donnie Wright. And Donnie and Dennis Lyons, who's my perpetrator, met in prison. So Dennis learned of my single mother, and he learned of me through Donnie while he was still in prison. And so being a sex offender, he had planned to take advantage of that situation before he even left prison. So he asked Donnie if he could arrange that he meet our family. So Donnie asked my mom if he could befriend him, you know. My mom had a habit of, like, adopting people, taking them under her wing, finding work for them and things like that. And so days after being released from prison, Dennis was at our front door, and I was only 9 years old. Dennis used classic child molester techniques to groom me with. He began to show interest in everything that I did. He did things like buy me ice cream and watch movies with me. I was only seeing my father every other weekend at this point, and Dennis knew that I was vulnerable and impressionable and in great need of a father figure. Dennis Lyons is 37 years older than me. My mother was working two jobs, and she was never around, and Dennis knew that, and he would just show up at our house when I was alone. I was 11 years old when Dennis raped me for the first time. It was awful and painful, and it was just the beginning. He continued to mentally and sexually abuse me for the next 10 years of my life, and that also included two abortions that took place in the state of Oregon. After the sentencing of Dennis last month, a woman walked up to me outside the courtroom. Her name's Kelly, and she hugged me, and she was saying thank you to me, and she explained that she had been a victim of Dennis when she was 13 in the 1970s. She'd heard of the trial through a family member of Dennis, and she wanted to be there to see it for closure for herself. So Dennis will never stop manipulating and molesting little girls unless he dies in prison. And I don't believe that pedophiles can ever be cured. I believe that the rehabilitation programs and probation don't work for pedophiles. He was caught and put in prison in 1994 for a very similar thing that he had done to me, and he was released after only 18 months. And then he came straight to my front door. He was on post-prison probation for 8.5 years after he was released, but all during that 8.5 years, he was molesting me and raping me. He also, a huge thing was he was failing all of his polygraphs through that rehabilitation program that he was in, and on one occasion, he was even pulled over in a car with me when I was 13. And so even with the failed polygraphs and being pulled over with me and arrested at 13 years old, he still was free and able to abuse me. So what I'm here to say is that if in 1994, Dennis had been sentenced to 75 months, as it stands with Measure 11 now, instead of 18 months back in 1994, he wouldn't have ever been in the position to do to me what he did to me. I would have been 15 years old instead of 9, and with the life events that were taking place within my family when I was 15, it would have been impossible for Dennis to have weaseled his way into my family's or my life. I don't think I would have ever known him at all. Instead, I lost my childhood and my adolescence, and I was changed forever. The mental and sexual abuse that was inflicted on me affects me every area of my life. You know, today I have so much mental and emotional trauma that I really, you know, it's hard to even explain to somebody how I get through day to day, but I struggle with school, employment, family relationships, and my own identity still. So it's horrific, the crimes that he committed toward me, and I can't even imagine, you know, if you know, last month he would have only gotten, you know, like 5 years. It's just for what he did to me and those kind of crimes. I don't believe that the 18 months for that first conviction was even enough. Like I said, I wouldn't have ever even known him if he would have gotten the 75. But thank you for allowing me to testify. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. I'll ask if there are any questions for either Mr. Herman or Ms. Leavenworth. Okay. I don't see any. We very much appreciate you joining us by phone and sharing your perspective and your experience. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Herman, any questions for Mr. Herman?
No.
I don't. Thank you very much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you.
Our next panel is Amanda Green, Susie Elwood, and Bree Atkins. And just so you're ready, the next group after that will be Jody Beretta, Matt Kenny, Kearney, and Alma Cooper.
Good morning, Chairs Garrett, Olson, Prasansky, and Winters, and members of the Joint Committee on Public Safety. My name is Amanda Green, and I am here today to testify in support of the Oregon Public Safety Package, House Bill 3194. I would like to voice my support of House Bill 3194, not only as an advocate working for victims' rights and violence prevention, but also as a survivor of sexual violence. House Bill 3194 is important to me because I want to improve Oregon's public safety system for victims. Oregon can balance holding people who commit crimes accountable while improving our public safety system by reinvesting public safety dollars to improve services for victims of crime. This will make individuals, families, and communities across Oregon safer. At the age of 16, I was drugged and assaulted by my boyfriend, whom, although I had only been dating for 2 months, I had gone to school and church with since kindergarten. After the assault, he threatened and emotionally manipulated me into silence. It was 3 years before I was able to talk about my abuse. In that 3 years of silence, I developed an eating disorder and suffered from crippling anxiety issues that resulted in my having to take a year off of college. And then I found help, or rather, help found me. To be frank, I really wasn't aware that help was to be had after my assault. No one had ever spoken to me about sexual violence. When I stumbled across Promoting Awareness Victim Empowerment, or PAVE, in college, I was connected to both individual and group therapy and many other survivors with whom I could share. And eventually, I was empowered enough to start helping other survivors. In my several years of prevention and advocacy work, I have had the opportunity to walk many survivors through the process of healing injustice. Repeatedly, the same issues have come up, barriers in the justice system and a veritable lack of available services, especially for low-income survivors and those from historically marginalized communities. In my own struggles with sexual violence and those I've witnessed, I cannot overemphasize the importance of services being available after the crime. While I never sought justice for my crime through the criminal justice system, I know that the reason I was able to become the person that I am today and to live a full, healthy, and happy life is because of the access that I had to both individual and group therapy, and also the access I had to another, just a full community of survivors with whom I could find the path to healing. The survivors I've worked with and shared with over the years are some of the most hopeful and optimistic people I've ever met. There is so much hope out there, even under the bleakest of circumstances, but this hope is only garnered when survivors can have access to the appropriate assistance they need and whole communities that can support them. Let me speed up here. Nothing can take away the violence that has already occurred, but with support, survivors do not have to be stuck in the trauma from violence. For Oregon to thrive, it's imperative that no survivor is ever stuck, and this will require resources to fund domestic and sexual violence services that provide support for survivors. House Bill 3194 has the right balance of ensuring that people who commit a crime are held accountable for the actions they make, and it makes Oregon smarter on crime by reinvesting a portion of correction savings into victim services. Ensuring that we have a strong public safety system is part of creating the safe and strong communities that we all want to live in. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony, and again, I ask for your support of House Bill 3194.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Susie Elwood. I'm a victim advocate at the Illinois Valley Safe House Alliance, and I'm here speaking on behalf of Chris Millett, the executive director. We help survivors of domestic and sexual violence in Josephine County find safety and rebuild their lives. I submit this testimony in support of House Bill 3194. Domestic and sexual violence are serious crimes that often create ripple effects through the rest of the survivor's life and the lives of the survivor's family, friends, and communities. I support House Bill 3194, moving some Measure 11 crimes into the sentencing guidelines, because this still allows for offenders to be held accountable, and it will help rebalance public safety spending to ensure local community public safety structures can hold offenders accountable and better meet victims' needs. Victims in Josephine County are counting on Oregon to rebalance public safety spending. The Alliance saw a 29% increase in requests for services in 2012, but an 80% reduction in our budget due to loss of federal funding through the VAWA rural program. We often find survivors camping out outside our advocacy center. They can't call 911. There's frequently no sheriff who can respond. It's very dark at night, and their abuser knows this. There's no help for them, and they're easy to find. Women are staying with their abusers rather than take a chance on hitchhiking those 30 or 60 miles into Grants Pass. They're staying with friends that are sometimes only marginally better than their abusers, sometimes worse. Survivors are getting angry with us, asking, "Why don't you have any help for me?" The legislature has a clear path forward to provide the help that survivors need. The Governor's Commission on Public Safety recommended that the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, ODSVS, receive reinvestment from averted prison growth. ODSVS is the most important funding source that programs across the state have. Other funding streams, such as the VAWA rural funding we used to receive, are designated for specific purposes or are time limited. ODSVS provides the stability our programs need to keep our doors open. Reinvesting a portion of savings from averted prison growth into ODSVS would enable programs such as the Safe House Alliance to keep their lights on and continue to serve victims. Domestic violence is a statewide epidemic, and 150 Oregonians have been killed in domestic violence-related murders in the last 4 years. This cannot continue when there is such an obvious path forward for increasing safety for survivors, families, and entire communities. Please increase safety by passing House Bill 3194 and reinvesting a portion of savings into domestic and sexual violence services. Prisons are an important part of a public safety system, but they are not the only important part. It's time Oregon gets a handle on correction spending and invests in critical programs like life-saving victim services. I hope you will join me in supporting House Bill 3194 and survivors of domestic and sexual violence. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Bree Akins, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women to testify in support of the Oregon Public Safety Package, HB 3194. I have been helping crime victims find safety and rebuild their lives for over 14 years, and it is vital that crime victim survival that Oregon updates our public safety system. My extensive career has enabled me to understand quite well why this balance is important. I've worked for over 7 years as a victim advocate, for over 4 years at the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. I'm also a member of Oregon's Sex Offender Treatment Board. These experiences have helped me to see the issue of public safety from many sides and to understand the importance of balancing each of these in order to support victims, hold offenders accountable, and keep our community safe. Our current system does not work, and it is not sustainable. In the past decade, Oregon's prison population has grown by nearly 50% to over 14,000 inmates, and taxpayers now spend more than $1.3 billion per biennium to pay for corrections. Oregon's prison bed population is projected to increase by 2,300 beds during the next 10 years at a cost of $600 million. At the same time, as you've already heard, current combined state and federal funding is less than half that amount needed for core emergency services to victims of domestic and sexual violence. What we know from sex offender treatment and management is that one size does not fit all. Each offender is different, and judges need to have the ability to consider the circumstances of each case in order to understand each offender's risk and make decisions about sentencing and treatment that will keep victims and our community safe. I've submitted this nice little infographic for you all to see. Please note we've corrected the source to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and submitted a corrected version. What this shows is that in 2012, there were 148 people who had sex abuse one as the highest charge. They had an average of 100 months each for their convictions, which cost about $38.5 million. With the modest provisions in HB 3194, we see that that average will come down to about 75 months each, with a savings of about $10 million, which is exactly what is needed to support core emergency domestic and sexual violence services. HB 3194 will still allow for long consecutive sentences, and the savings generated could easily be spent in impactful places that increase safety for victims and our communities. Oregon needs to be more cost-effective and strategic in its use of incarceration while investing in the programs proven to reduce future crime and recidivism at a fraction of the cost. I believe that HB 3194 is a step in the right direction to balancing our public safety system in order to support victims, hold offenders accountable, and keep our community safe. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sex abuse one carries a 75-month, and so you were saying 100 months was the highest crime charged with sex abuse ones. What crimes did they commit?
What crimes did they commit? I mean, we're hearing from the district attorneys, we're hearing these horrific cases of the rape and sodomy and so on, and they plead those down.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be interesting to me.
Yeah, we would probably need to go back to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to find that out,
okay.
Because obviously that's the crime that they were convicted on, not necessarily the crime they convicted.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, panel, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Okay, so yes, we have Jody Burita, Matt Kearney, and Alma Cooper, and then the panel following them will be April Rains, Rolando Ramirez, and Katie Riley.
Thank you, Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Jody Beretta, and I'm a Deputy District Attorney for Marion County, here representing Marion County and also ODAA. I'm here in opposition of 3194. Specifically, I wanted to address my comments to the reduction of sentences under Measure 57. I wanted to express how necessary keeping the current presumptive of Measure 57 is in protecting the public from career property offenders. And I just wanted to give you one example of a Marion County offender who was sentenced under Measure 57 earlier this year. And this is a defendant who was sentenced just a few weeks ago. He was 32 years old at the time of the sentencing. By the time he was 18, he had already committed 3 misdemeanor theft offenses and victimized 4 separate people in this community. And I use the word victim very deliberately because I think it's very easy in discussing property crimes and career property offenders to put them in the category of victimless crimes, and they are not. These are people who are getting their homes burgled, who are getting their property taken, and families who are being deeply affected. After turning 18 and leading up to the year 2012, this same person was arrested 36 times. He was convicted of 4 misdemeanor thefts, 3 other non-property felonies, 2 separate identity thefts, 2 separate theft in the first degrees, and 7 separate unlawful use of vehicles. He stole 7 different families' cars. In fact, the only time that he was not committing offenses was the time he was serving in prison. In 2012, he committed a burglary in the first degree when he broke into a family's home, stole their property while the family slept on the second floor. He committed 2 separate identity thefts. He eluded police officers twice, and he stole, last year alone, 7 more vehicles. Now, this is a man who's a prolific property offender. In September of 2012, he is the perfect example of why these property offenders don't just take our belongings, but they actually endanger our safety. In September of last year, he stole a car and a trailer. Police found him and began to pursue him. He led them on a high-speed chase where he entered I-5 on the on-ramp going in the opposite direction of traffic. He was driving at 70 miles per hour for miles, going against traffic on I-5, endangering everybody on that freeway. He was released on supervised release because he happened to be on post-prison supervision at the time. He was also under release agreement when in December of 2012, he stole another car. He was again found by police, led them on another high-speed chase, and this time he crashed into a house. His car, stolen car, crashed through the bedroom of a child. These are the type of offenders that Measure 57, that are being sentenced under Measure 57. For the consistency, for the continued deterrence, and for community safety, it's important that you keep what the people of Oregon have told you they want, which is these career property offenders being put in prison for the presumptive that is currently in place. And I oppose 3194 for that reason.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the special committee. My name is Matt Kemmy. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County. I'm here today on behalf of Marion County District Attorney and with the support of the ODAA as well. I'm here today in opposition to the proposed changes to ballot measure 11 and House Bill 3194, in particular, the portion of the bill addressing the second look for juvenile offenders. And I'd like to talk to you today about a case I did almost 4 years ago. On June 3rd, 2009, 2 juveniles, at the time age 16 and 17, attacked a young man named Rosendo Garcia Jr., who at the time was 19. He goes by Ron, and that's what I'll refer to him as. Now, by way of written material, I've submitted a picture. I guess it's 2 pictures on one page. It's a picture of Ron as he appeared before the attack, and then it's an image of his skull as a result of that attack. Now, the two juveniles who assaulted him were gangsters. They're members of Vatos Locos, which is a subset of the Sereños, or Southsiders, which, as I'm sure you know, is a powerful gang here in Oregon, frankly, throughout the country. Ron was not a gangster. He was, however, provoked into a fight, and one he initially engaged in. That was a mistake. The two juveniles, each armed with baseball bats, struck Ron almost simultaneously. One hit him in the jaw, the other hit him from behind in the back of the skull, and dropped him to the street. He was unconscious, and from that point on, absolutely helpless. The two juveniles then stood over the top of him and struck him repeatedly, over and over, with such force that the one who had a wooden bat, as opposed to aluminum, actually shattered the bat. He simply grabbed another bat and continued assaulting him. Witnesses who saw it said it sounded and looked like two men furiously chopping wood. They continued their assault right up until people said that they were calling the police. At that point, and only at that point, did they stop and they fled. Now, if you look at the image that I provided, you'll see the image of the skull. His skull is literally broken from every side, and his face is absolutely destroyed. His brains, and I'm sparing you the graphic photos. His brains were spilling out the hole where his nose once was, and because there was no facial structure, his eyeballs, as odd as the sounds, dropped down into the area where his mouth was. When police and first responders arrived, he appeared dead. It was only the occasional gurgling and the bubbles in his face that gave the impression that perhaps he was still breathing. In fact, he was. He was rushed to the emergency room where his initial surgery took 27 hours. Doctors worked in shifts to save his life and to rebuild his face. And the trauma to his face was so severe that they didn't even notice he had a broken arm for 2 weeks. Ron was in a coma for a period of 2 months. Since that time, he has had more surgeries than his family can even count. In one of those surgeries, they took one of his ribs and used it to, I guess, build him a nose since he no longer had one. Today, Ron is blind. He's deaf in one ear, and he suffers from brain damage. However, against all odds, he has relearned how to eat on his own, to walk, and to talk. For the crimes, both juveniles were convicted of attempted murder and assault in the first degree. Both ballot measure 11 crimes, 90-month sentences. They each got 90-month sentences running consecutive to one another for the legal maximum, which was 180 months or 15 years. At the time of sentencing, the Honorable Joseph C. Gamon told the defendants, 15 years is not nearly enough for what you did. The rest of your lives would be a punishment commensurate for what the victim suffered here. That would be a fair sentence, but I can't do that. I'm bound to follow the law, and I will follow the law. Apparently, Judge Gamon didn't even feel that the 15 years was enough. And frankly, I think the victims agree with that. But if this law changes, that 15 years could be cut in half. And those two defendants could be walking the streets as gangsters at ages 23 and 24, respectively. Now, Ron is present in the court today. He's a gentleman seated behind me. He's taken off his glasses. He's on the aisle. He's wearing a black shirt. And his mother, Alma Cooper, is present, and she'd like to testify for you, and she can tell you, I guess, from the victim's perspective.
Thank you. Ms. Cooper?
I don't even have words because it's hard to talk. All these 4 years has been hard for my family and for me.
Would you please introduce yourself?
Alma Cooper.
Thank you.
I'm his mom. All these years has been hard on me and him. I just don't want to see those kids to get out before their time. I would like to see they do their time because I feel like they deserve that for what they've done to my son and to my family, especially me, because it's been really hard till this day. We can never heal. We live day by day, but we all know we got to move on. But it's not very easy for us. And I just want you guys to hear that. It's very painful.
Thank you for being here to speak to us. Are there any questions? Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. Kimmy, based on your review of the case, and it sounds like the individuals in this case were convicted of attempted murder?
Yes.
Attempted murder, which is not one of the three that we're looking at. Is that correct?
My understanding is any crime for juveniles, not murder. Is that wrong?
I believe that's wrong.
Okay. Then I stand corrected.
Any additional questions?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Olson.
I'm sorry.
Jody, just real quick, you were talking about the repeat property offenders. Maybe you can just share with me, cannot the judge do consecutive sentencing in that type of situation?
I think so.
I mean, that goes outside of the 24 months generally what would be in that situation?
Co-Chair Garrett, Representative Olson, a judge for separate victims certainly has the ability to impose consecutive sentences.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And if I could follow up.
Yes.
Jody, also on that particular case, would you consider that in your practice one of the more extreme cases of someone that's, let's say, completely out of control compared to the other type of charges that you would be bringing forward on other individuals? It seems like that, from my practice of 20-something years, more on the, let's say, the extreme side of someone that's totally out of control compared to a lot of the stuff that you probably see on a more regular basis.
Co-Chair Garrett, Senator Brzezinski, I would say that it is in the category of the more egregious offenders, okay. But in my experience with the type of frequency of these the property offenders, this is certainly not an exception. We have six lawyers right now with on their desk at least, I'd say, five of these type of offenders that they're currently dealing with. One of the problems is just the revolving door of the jail and inactive supervision.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel. We appreciate your testimony.
I have just one second, please. Co-Chair Olson. If I could just supplement my previous answer to Co-Chair Brzezinski, I think I was addressing the second look, and I think I am right on that.
Okay, I'm not I didn't hear that. I didn't hear you say second look.
Yes, so that, what I was heard was my testimony.
Based on the charges of what the type of sentence was given to him.
Correct. That's what I was talking about. Okay.
If we have, Representative Hicks.
Can I just, and so please, what were the ages of the defendants?
They were again? 16 and 17.
And so, quick math. So you've got 9 years, 8 years till they get to 25. And so from your understanding of the bill, about how much time could have possibly been eliminated from the sentence that they actually got?
I think it would be 90 months. They got two 90-month sentences running consecutive. So if you eliminated half, that would be 90 months, which is about 7.5 years.
Okay.
So a 16-year-old, and again, I'm not good at math, would be about 23. The 17-year-old would be about 24.
Thanks.
Thank you. And can I just ask a follow-up question? I mean, we're talking about second looks. So your point is at a certain time, those juveniles would have been eligible for review by a judge. We're not talking about automatic shortening of sentences here. We're talking about review. Isn't that right?
Yes, it would not be automatic.
Okay.
I guess from our standpoint, the victims who've been through so much are entitled to sort of a finality. Maybe they don't agree that 15 years was even enough in light of what the damage done was.
Right.
But they can sort of make peace with 15 years and know that for 15 years they don't have to worry, as opposed to in 7.5 years having to come in, testify, relive it, face the perpetrator, and then, I guess, have somebody else determine what happens.
Understood. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
April Raines, Rolando Ramirez, and Katie Riley. And then the following group will be Rob Bovet, Steve Dole, and Judge Charles Bailey.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is April Raines, and I work as a marketing executive for a medical company as well as a board member for Partnership for Safety and Justice. I'm the mother of two children and an active member of this community. I come to you as someone who has seen the criminal and juvenile justice systems from all sides. From 2005 to 2008, I volunteered for the Marion County District Attorney's Office as a victim advocate. As a young girl, I received great help from a victim advocate who helped me rebuild my life after being victimized. I wanted to give back the great service that I received as a victim. The victim advocate helped to see that there was really more to life than just becoming a victim. Then, in 2009, my 15-year-old son
hurt someone in my family and was convicted of a Measure 11 sex offense crime and sentenced to over 6 years of incarceration. At the time of his conviction, I was working as a victim advocate with the DA's office, so I knew he needed to be held accountable for what he did, and he needed help. As a mother and an advocate for victims, I want to work towards rebuilding our family and making sure my son will not make such poor choices in the future. Before my son committed this crime, he was a good kid, involved in our church, loved animals, on the swim team in high school, had never been in trouble. He made an awful choice, but that did not define all of who he was. Once he was charged with the crime, it was like none of that mattered. His victim was another family member, so I was really seeing and feeling everything from all sides. But we couldn't get the DAs to listen to what was best for our family. Our voices were not listened to, and we were never heard in front of a judge to make our case. Because of how Measure 11 works, a judge is not involved in any stage of the process. We had no one to make our case to except for the DA. Judges need to have their authority restored to them so they can determine whether the youth should be tried in adult criminal justice system and sent to adult jail, or tried in the juvenile justice system and sent to juvenile facility, and say have some say in how much time they get. That's why I'm here testifying before you today. I want other Oregonians to know what's happening to our youth and be a part of change. My son is now in the fourth year of his six-year sentence. The Oregon Youth Authority has done great work with him to help him understand the consequences of his bad choices and taught him how to make better ones. We are thankful for the good program he has received at OIA. But he was convicted of a Measure 11 offense. He is not eligible for a second look hearing. He has successfully completed all of his programming, graduated high school, has his welding certificates, and is enrolled in Shemecketa. Staff tell us he is ready to go home, and we know it's time for him to move on for the next phase of his life, which involves the independent responsibility he needs to take outside of a facility. Under a Measure 11, there is no room to evaluate my son or the countless other youth I meet there that are ready for the next phase. Don't get me wrong. Some of those kids deserve to be there. Some of them need more time, but others deserve a chance to at least have their progress reviewed in front of a judge. When my son does get out, he will have an adult felony conviction on his record and will have to register as a sex offender. These barriers to successful employment and his own housing will be massive. He needed the treatment OIA offered, but could have and would have received it if he would have been convicted in the juvenile system. I know the reforms in House Bill 3194, including Second Look, will not be retroactive, so I'm not here advocating for policies that will affect my family. I'm here because I know Oregon can and should do better when it comes to youth. Further, from my perspective from both sides of the system, I support House Bill 3194 for its balanced approach to public safety, and also support House Bill 3193 that would allow waiver hearing for youth charged with Measure 11 crimes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Rolando Ramirez. I am currently with the work with the Oregon Youth Authority since 1999. Since my first day, I've held the same position working out of the Office of Minority Services. My main assignment working at McLaren, the Youth Correctional Facility in Woodburn. I work with minority youth with a focus with the Latino and Hispanic youth and their families. I ensure that they have access to services that are culturally and language appropriate. I've been doing gang intervention groups for about the last 10 years. I'm one of the technical support people that support a group called Street Smarts, which is our gang intervention treatment program at all of OYA. While I work for OYA, I'm here to speak for myself in support of the package, House Bill 3194. Knowing how little time I have before you, which is really difficult if you know me at all, is to get right to the point. When it comes down to youth and kids in our criminal justice system, one size does not fit all. And that's one of the things that I've heard here over and over. One of the things that I've also heard is that accountability is a must. I don't think there's anybody here that does not say accountability is not a must. I can surely speak from experience on those issues as well, but from here, the issues get very gray, and our systems need to be a little gray. It's not always black and white. To adequately serve our victims, our incarcerated youth, our taxpayers, as well as provide needed resources for prevention programs. I'm very supportive of Second Look. It is an added incentive for youth to start taking care of business when they know they can earn the opportunity to reduce their sentence and begin to rebuild their lives in the communities they come from. Second Look in no way guarantees release. It gives kids a chance to say and show that they deserve another shot. Giving back to the judicial authority on some Measure 11 crimes will also free up OIA bed spaces that are available for youth that are ready to go to come to our system under a supervised transition and help us deal with many kids who should be coming to our programs on us every single day. Before I worked with OYA, my mindset was a little different. My brother, Sheriff Raul Ramirez, worked for the Marion County Sheriff's Office for 30-some years and also was the elected sheriff for over 10 years, up to his retirement. I have another brother who worked for the Department of Corrections, and I have a sister-in-law who's a defense attorney. Our motto kind of was, one brother arrests them, my sister-in-law defends them, and I guard them, or we would guard them. One of the things that has changed in my thought process is that, you know, I want to help these kids transition back into the communities where they came from. Working here and working with the Oregon Youth Authority has helped me do that. I've met hundreds of Measure 11 kids, and the tragedy for many of them is that after participating in our programs at the Oregon Youth Authority, they're still going through hills and valleys of being held accountable when they're ready to move on, but cannot do it because of the sentence guidelines and no second look. They're faced up to a lot of the hurts that they have caused, have been trained on de-escalating violence, moderating their emotions, and learning basic citizenship skills, things that some were never taught as children. We should be giving them the pathway of controlled supervision back to being productive citizens, but most times we cannot. Youth who come to OYA as Department of Correction commits don't have the luxury of sitting around in OYA. And our facilities are waiting to get sent up to Department of Corrections. In some cases, after years of us providing opportunities and resources for them to engage in, do you know the way that they prepare for the future of Department of Corrections? That's by lifting weights and mentally preparing for what they believe is life in DOC.
Can you wrap it up, please?
Yes, sir. Thanks. This is pretty much an exact opposite of how things work for them in OYA. Based on years of experience with OYA, I feel strongly that Second Look and the Measure 11 changes in House Bill 3194 would be a positive impact on our youth who are committed to as adults. I'll end there, and thank you very much for
your
time.
Ms. Riley.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Katie Riley, and I am a volunteer with the Oregon Public Health Association. I am also a retired faculty member in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at OHSU. I am here today in support of House Bill 3194. In the years since Measure 11 was passed, we have learned that the adolescent brain is not fully developed until approximately 25 years. Adolescents are impulsive and can make quick decisions that they later regret. If they are incarcerated at an early age for a long period, they are kept away from normal social interactions and responsibilities that would give them the opportunity to mature appropriately. In addition, if they are incarcerated with older felons, they are more likely to commit further crimes when they are released. It is important that consequences for youth who break the law be immediate. They be accountable. And it be immediate. However, long-term incarceration, particularly if incarcerated with adults, can further hinder their development. Personally, in our family, my son, who was 17 at the time, committed a Measure 11 offense, was charged. He served almost 4 years before being released under a Second Look plea bargain agreement over 13 years ago. The plea bargain came from the DA, one day before he was scheduled to go to trial and after he had been in county jail for 6 months with adults. Under Second Look, incarcerated youth have to prove themselves to the sentencing judge, and anyone who is released has to serve on probation and post-prison supervision for the rest of their sentence. My son benefited greatly from the Second Look opportunity. It gave him incentive to do his best while incarcerated, and he also benefited from the transition program. Since his release, he has had no problems with the law. In fact, his experiences have helped him find his calling in life as he now works with youth as a gang outreach counselor in Portland. He has dedicated his life to helping youth avoid problems and to avoid incarceration. Every day, my son drives into Portland and works with gang-affected youth, often on the streets late at night. He has given talks about drugs, gangs, and violence to the National Indian Youth Police Academy, the Native American Juvenile Justice Summit, Straight Talk, and the Governor's Summit on Overrepresentation of Minority Youth, where he was awarded a Governor's Youth Award for his service. He views working with youth as his purpose in life and his joy. He has turned his life around to become a productive member of society. House Bill 3194 would give other youth the chance to prove themselves. However, I would also recommend going even further, and I endorse House Bill
3193, which waives youth to juvenile court. And I would also recommend making the provisions of House Bill 3194 retroactive. Youth who serve time under Measure 11 are still branded as ex-felons for life. They have difficulties with housing, with jobs. My son has faced those problems. They have difficulties with education. And it hinders their full reintegration into the community. And so this is where, when they come back into the community, they can be productive members of society, be taxpaying adults, and be contributors rather than users of the community. And I fully appreciate your listening to my testimony. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, panel, very much. Coming up now is Rob Bovet, Steve Dole, and Judge Bailey. And then the following group will be Thad Bentz, Jessica Kemp, and just those two.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm the Lincoln County District Attorney. I won't repeat any of what my colleagues have said, and I'm going to stay before that red light hits, I promise.
Thanks.
I believe in science. Many of you know me. I believe in data and science-based policies. I started four diversionary programs in Lincoln County to deal with the underlying causes of crime, such as substance abuse, domestic violence, mental health. We were the first to start a HOPE program in the state of Oregon to divert Measure 57 offenders out of prison and to treat the underlying issues, mostly addiction in those cases. So I believe in science. I believe in doing policy based on data. Unfortunately, I've analyzed the data, as many of my colleagues have, that was presented to the committee, the commission, actually, and I believe it was, how shall I say this nicely? I can't think of a kind word. Wrong. And I read the Willamette Week article a few weeks ago, and I said, that's exactly what I want you to hear. And so I don't have written testimony for you. I know it's in the record, but that's exactly everything I was thinking when I was reading that article. That's what I want you to hear. Now, having said that, I support 3195, oppose 3194. I think there are some things we can do, such as what's in 3195, and I think there are some additional things we can do to extract money out of the current public safety system and fund the vital programs that you've heard many of these folks talk about that are in desperate need of funding. 3194 is just not the right way to go about it. We can do 3195. I think there's some additional things we can do in the area of drug policy to save more money provide support for programs. I'm going to stay under that red light and stop here and see if you have any questions for me.
Nope. Distinguished members, thank you very much. My name's Charlie Bailey, a judge in Washington County, Oregon. I got to tell you, it's a little different to be on this side giving testimony than actually being up where you would be receiving testimony. I guess I'm here because I was asked to come down and talk about, as a judge, one of those would be opposed to House Bill 3194. I understand you've had some of my brethren come in and talk about how they are in favor of House Bill 3194 because it gives them more discretion. I'm here to tell you I disagree with that. I think there are certain portions, and I'm here specifically talking about the Measure 11 portions. The other portions, I would have other arguments to make for you all, but I would not be able to stay within the green line. So in regards to Measure 11, I think it's important to understand why I don't think that this does give the discretion that some of those folks have talked about. In many of the cases, and I think some of you who know me, before I used to be a prosecutor, I was a prosecutor and worked on child abuse cases, and I can tell you there weren't many cases as a prosecutor that I worked on in which, if it was not a ballot Measure 11 type of offense, we didn't take it out of the ballot Measure 11. That's already happening. And that discretion we already have as judges to impose whatever sentence is appropriate. I understand folks think the DAs have that sort of discretion. We have judges always have the inherent power to say, we don't want to do that. We think it's inappropriate to do that, and we can do that. Secondly, we already have the power to do what this bill says we can do. We already have the power under State v. Buck and State v. Rodriguez to turn around and say, this is unconscionable, therefore unconstitutional, and we take an oath to do that. And if we believe something is unconstitutional, we have a duty to make sure we do not impose that particular sentence. And we can already impose the types of sentences that are here in House Bill 3194. So we already have the discretion that's in House Bill 3194 in regards to Measure 11 sentences. What I don't think many of my brethren have come and talked to you about is what this really does is actually limit some of our discretion. What we do not have is in certain types of situations when there are those types of sex offenders, having worked on those types of cases, and specifically with children. I know the impact that it can have on those children and their families, and not just at the time that they're going through the process, but for the rest of their lives. And the difficulty with this bill is there are sometimes I will never be able to get to a proper sentence if the proper sentence was 70 months with no programs. I cannot get there under this bill. There are no way for me to get there. And I think that's important to understand. This actually, as do sentencing guidelines inherently, take away my discretion. So House Bill 3194 doesn't get more discretion for me in the first place. So that's why I think it doesn't work. Secondly, I want to talk about the costs that I understand. And I completely concur with everybody. As a treatment court provider, I believe we need more money out there for treatment. Totally believe that. And I hope that this group will take a look at that and fund appropriately those types of programs. That's a whole different thing. Understandably, on these costs, it's a promise that I don't think you can keep to these folks under this bill. If there are savings, there's no way you can promise that the future legislatures will give that money appropriately. Senate Bill 1145 back in the day, I think you'll have many counties tell you, to this day they don't believe they've been fully funded for what this body said would happen to them. And if they had that funding, I think they could have done a lot better in some of these cases and do some of these programs already that this bill set design. I'll answer any questions. I realize my red light is up, and as an attorney, we like to go on and talk, so I'll stop at this point. If anybody has any questions, more than happy to answer them.
Thank you, Judge. Appreciate you being here. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. It's 2013, and this is the 30th year that Crime Victims United has been around. It's our 30th year anniversary. We're proud of that. It's the longest standing crime victims organization in the state of Oregon. I want to thank you for hearing Marnie Leavenworth from the Washington County case that testified to you from Utah today telephonically, and I appreciate you allowing that to happen, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Crime Victims United is against much of 3194. It will come to you as no surprise. We are against any changes to Measure 11. We oppose any changes to Measure 57. We oppose 30% earn time. We oppose the alternative incarceration program changes. And we oppose Second Look. Now, given that, there are parts of 3194 that we support. We support the change to the marijuana sentencing. We support the changes to driving while suspended or revoked, except for the fact we disagree with the ODAA on the fact that we think that if somebody has committed a homicide previously, however that homicide was committed through vehicular, that they should still go to prison if they get a DWS. We support the program assessment portions of the bill, and we support the correction resources portion of the bill. So we are not here as obstructionists. There's ways to get to where we all want to get without destroying the voter-approved sentences that the voters not only voted on once, but when it came to Measure 11, twice. Voted on once the bill you gave them, Measure 57. Voted several times on crime victims' rights. I know that's not on the table, but they have repeatedly spoke loud and clear how they feel about crime and victims' rights in this state. I'm probably one of the few people in this room who's actually sat through a remand hearing. We don't want to go back to the days or waiver hearing. We don't want to go back to the days when victims were put on pins and needles waiting for a remand or waiver hearing to come around to find out if their perpetrator, just because they happen to be under the age of 18, are going to be tried as adults or juveniles. We did that with my family. The murderer of my daughter was a juvenile. And we waited and waited and waited to have that hearing. We finally had it. I think it stands on record as the longest, if not one of the longest, waiver hearings that's ever been held in this state. Most waiver hearings, even for murder, are 2 to 4 days. Ours lasted 2 weeks. So we had to wait to find out what was going to happen to him. We don't want to see that happen to any other victims. second look. You know, you had a young man in front of you that spoke in favor of second look, and he had an exposure of 20 years on the crimes that he did. He was a young man that sat with the OIA people here, and Bracken McKee addressed his case last night. He got 8 years and 4 months on an exposure of 20 years. He got his second look, yet he had the temerity to sit in front of you and want to cut that to four years and 2 months. That's not right. Anyway, I've distributed a piece on the provisions of Senate Bill 1049 and House Bill 2494 and House Bill 2379. I think it's been a much overlooked portion of what the reality is of how Measure 11 works, and I'd ask you to particularly look at the second page of that and look at what has actually happened when it comes to departures and probation on the three crimes that you're looking at, assault 2, rob 2, and sex abuse 1, and I know I'm way over time, and thank your indulgence, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I'll take any questions
you.
If you'd
any
like.
Questions for our panel? Senator Pazanski.
Rob, and I think Steve, both of you have said there may be some other things we could look at. I'm wondering if you could put on the record for us what those things are as to achieving the goals of getting money to reinvest into the local level for reentry and cutting recidivism, which of course reduces victimization.
Co-chairs, Senator Pazanski, I knew you were going to put me on the spot. I work in the area of drug policy, as you know, and I think there are some things we can do with who's in prison right now, who will be going to prison under our current structures based on certain drug crimes. And I think we can avoid some of those. I think we can divert some of those, and I think there can be real savings there. And I think you can take those savings and you can start to fund or additionally enhance some of the programs, the vital programs for victim support that you've heard about. It would be inappropriate for me to go into other areas of the law because, as you know, I've spent my whole career dealing with drug crimes and drug policy. So I'll avoid getting into any of the other categories, but that's where I would be looking.
Steve?
As I said, we support raising the using the federal threshold for the marijuana crimes. I may not like it. Some on the dais may like it or may not like it, but legalization's coming. And we have to prosecute those people for marijuana crimes as long as marijuana is illegal in this state. But I say don't send them to prison. I say leave them in the community, put them on probation. If they have to do a little local jail time, so be it. And in fact, I would go as far, and I know it'll make some of you cringe after the 3508 experience, but I would let them go now. They don't have any victims. I don't think that's going to be a problem if they go back to court. That ought to shake up the building a little bit. The DWS, as I said, I'd start handling them locally. If they have committed a homicide, I say they still need to go to prison. I would tell you this, that around Measure 11, I think there's some places without changing sentences, without lowering sentences, that we could make some changes that would save money. It may not be a lot, but we could save money. I don't feel comfortable talking about those on the record. I would be happy to talk to you in private about them in your offices. But the one part of it that I will talk about is this. Crime Victims United has been on the record since 1997 as wanting to apply the same opt-outs that are in Senate Bill 1049 and Senate Bill or House Bill 2379 to Sex Abuse 1 and the second-degree non-forcible sex crimes. We've been on the record since 1997. It's scary for me to think I've been around here this long. You want to cut the sentences. All we want to do is give the opt-out. The opt-out actually exists now, as I think some of you know, but it only exists where there's a five-year spreader between the age of the victim and the age of the perpetrator, similar to the three-year age spread that was in the law previously. And there were some in some other so-called crime victims groups that cringed when we said that, and yet now they're supporting House Bill 3194. So I'd only say this, you know, some of us get a reputation, we have to live with it, and I guess I'm this lock them up and throw away the keys guy, but some of those sentences even make the hair on the back of my head stand up a little bit. Now, if they come in and do it again, I say give them 6 years and 3 months plus. But those are some things I think we can actually talk about. But I will tell you this, don't go there with Measure 11. I don't change Measure 11. We oppose it. Don't change Measure 57. That's your bill. We oppose it. 30% earned time. We oppose it.
Thank you, Steve, thank you. For the follow-up.
Yep.
And
thank you
to the panel. Our next group is Thad Bentz and Jessica Camp. We have more people on both sides than we did the other day, so we're not going to finish by 3. I do want to hold this open so people who've come can have a chance to be heard. I know some members have other responsibilities starting at 3, so you may see some folks leave for other committees, but I at least will be here until we're finished, maybe another half hour, 40 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Campfee, and I'm an attorney at the Public Defender of Marion County. I'm here today to share some cases from my experience, just to give the committee an idea of the broad spectrum of types of cases that are charged under ballot measure 11. I'll start with an example of a sex abuse case. I have a client who's charged with sex abuse in the first degree. My client is a 20-year-old young man. He is accused of having sexual contact with a young lady. The sexual contact is alleged to have happened 2 days before this young lady's 14th birthday. Because it is 2 days before her birthday, he is charged under ballot measure 11 with having sexual contact with a child under the age of 14. He's subjected to a mandatory minimum sentence of 75 months. If the exact same conduct had been charged 2 days later, he'd be charged with a misdemeanor crime. And under ballot measure 11, my client, because he's more than 5 years older than this victim, is not eligible for an opt-out. A judge considering sentencing in this case would have no discretion but to impose the 75-month mandatory minimum sentence and could not consider the fact that the case was so close to being a misdemeanor. The second case that I'd like to discuss with you is a case of robbery in the second degree. I represented a woman who was accused of robbery of the second degree and facing a ballot measure 11 sentence of 70 months mandatory minimum. In this case, she had gone with a friend to a store, and the friend was shoplifting at the store. She was walking out of the store with her friend, and a security guard stopped them. The friend then got into a scuffle, essentially a shoving match with the security guard. Both women were charged with robbery in the second degree, aided by another actually present. I watched the store security video with my client, and it showed that she did nothing. She just stood by the side. And so we thought that she was not guilty of the crime and wanted to set the case on for a trial. The district attorney's office made her a plea bargain that would involve pleading to a lesser charge for a prison sentence in this case. My client seriously considered agreeing to go to prison to avoid a ballot measure 11 sentence. Ultimately, that's not how she chose to resolve her case. She decided to have a trial, and 2 days before trial, the district attorney dismissed the case. But the fact that she was facing a ballot measure 11 charge in that case caused her to very seriously consider agreeing to go to prison for conduct that she didn't even commit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of this committee. My name is Thaddeus Betts. I'm a public defender in Multnomah County and a little bit in Washington County now, too, for about the past 7 years. I currently represent both juveniles and adults charged with Measure 11 crimes. And I wanted to just take a brief moment and tell you about a 15-year-old man that I represented last year by the name of Jamal. Jamal was playing a police activities league basketball game one evening with a couple friends, and as they were walking home, Jamal took another child's cell phone, and his 14-year-old co-defendant pushed the victim of that theft, essentially, and that made it a robbery in the second degree. Jamal had just turned 15 years old, so he was held in custody and arraigned the next day. When I met Jamal at the arraignment, he asked me if he could go home now to his grandmother, and I had to ask him if he had $25,000 bail to meet the minimum requirement of $250,000 bail. Jamal started to cry. His grandmother was in tears, of course, as well. Jamal had never been away from his grandmother for more than about 24 or 48 hours. Jamal was faced with a sentence of 70 months, beginning, of course, at a youth correctional facility. He had no prior criminal history, and by the time Jamal was 16 years old, he had an adult felony criminal record. Before he could drive, before he probably really even had a girlfriend. He's still a juvenile. He's doing very well on probation, which is probably have been an appropriate result from the outset of that case. But of course, he was facing very serious conduct, very serious criminal consequences. I wanted to also briefly touch on the fact that in Multnomah County, had Jamal been offered a prison sentence for that case, it would have been a requirement in that prison sentence, even if it was a lower prison term, that he waive his ability to have a second look. That is, of course, led to what other witnesses have described as, you know, lost opportunity to sort of intervene in some of these youths' lives while they're at OYA and motivate them to reform themselves. I have to take a very brief last moment of my time to disagree respectfully with Judge Bailey that the Supreme Court cases of Rodriguez and Buck provide the same kind of discretion that these bills would allow the bench. It's just simply not accurate, I believe. Rodriguez and Buck are reserved for the most extreme unconstitutional circumstances in what we would consider egregiously unfair sentences. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
So in Multnomah County, he would have had to serve 70 months?
If he had been convicted of that offense, and there had was some, you know, dispute as to whether or not he would have fit the possibility of an opt-out, ultimately it didn't have to be tested by a court because the case resolved by plea agreement.
You said he wouldn't have a second look, so the opt-out isn't a second look?
It is District Attorney Underhill's policy at the moment that if you sort of plea that case down into a non-Measure 11 offense, but you're still given a prison sentence, that the defendant has to waive their right to a second wave hearing.
So a second look. I mean, they're reducing the charge to begin with.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
You.
Both
Thank you.
Of you. Alex Gardner, Jeff Howes, and Janice Deisinger, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Jeff Howes. I am the first assistant to Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill. I don't want anyone to presume that because District Attorney Underhill is not here, it's not because of a lack of interest. District Attorney Underhill was injured in a bicycle accident last night and can't be here and ask me to be here in his place. I'm speaking for him and on his behalf. And I'm doing so in opposition of this bill, House Bill 3194. You've heard a great deal of information, and I don't want to repeat it or parrot it. I've worked as a prosecutor for 18 years. More than half of that time was spent in the domestic violence unit, in the child abuse unit, and in the violent crimes unit, prosecuting sexual assaults mainly. I was one of four prosecutors in the child abuse unit from 2005 to 2008. I want to just take a minute to tell you how cases are negotiated in Multnomah County when a defendant is facing a serious crime like unlawful sexual penetration, sodomy one, rape one. In 90% of those cases, they're taken to a judicial settlement conference, most of those in front of our chief criminal judge, Julie Franz. We get together and we talk in chambers with usually a defendant's family, sometimes a victim or victim's family waiting in the wings. In an incredible number of those cases, I can't give you a percentage, it wouldn't be fair, but in a lot of those cases, Judge Franz will suggest that a person facing an unlawful sexual penetration charge plead to a sex abuse one because that's a lower sentence and oftentimes with a concurrent probation on a attempted unlawful sexual penetration. That's how we get to sexual abuse one in many, many cases in Multnomah County. Down from a more serious charge to a sex abuse one with a probation tailing on a more serious or slightly less serious attempted first-degree crime. The lawyers and leadership in Multnomah County District Attorney's Office are conscientious and diligent stewards of the public trust in the area of plea negotiations and sentencing recommendations. You heard on Wednesday night from a public defender for whom I have great respect and who I consider a friend. She talked about an assault in a second-degree case. And that case involved a 17-year-old female striking her brother with a candlestick. Now, advocacy aside, and that public defender used the word bop or bap to describe the strike and characterized the candlestick as light. But I don't want to get into that. But what I want to talk about is the result of that case, which was not spoken about on Wednesday night. Defendant pled to assault in the third degree, and I'll finish up right here, assault in the third degree, and was placed on probation. I checked this morning on how that person is doing, and since that defendant was placed on adult probation, she's had no negative contact with the criminal justice system. That, to me, folks, is a successful story. I know I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Mr. Rabbit.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Alex Gardner, and I'm the Lane County DA. I do know some of you. I hope others of you know me by reputation, that I am not a lock-em-up-and-throw-away-the-key kind of DA. I'm hearing some of these stories from proponents of 3194, and I'm struck by the facts they're describing, because Measure 11 offenders in Lane County, those who go via Measure 11, are by and large the sorts of people that everybody in our community think ought to be in prison. I want to talk about sex abuse in the first degree, because I watched some of the earlier testimony, and Senator Brzozinski asked Ms. Zuber if she had seen a sex offender like the one she described, given a probationary sentence. I'm old enough to have tried those cases before Measure 11 was in place, and I can tell you that it happened with some regularity. I remember a Charles Otis, who was sexually abusing a 9-year-old little girl. We knew, but let me just back up and point out one thing that I think ought to be in the record. I think Oregon is blessed with some exceptionally capable, fine judges. The fact of the matter is many of them don't have criminal justice backgrounds. If they've worked in a DA's office or a public defender's office, they're probably, for any length of time, they would be intimately familiar with the way our system works. But many of them have civil backgrounds. And many of them with those backgrounds are asked to sentence on these sorts of cases without understanding them the way that public defenders and DAs do. They have a very short window at a sentencing hearing to decide what's right. And so now I'll turn to Mr. Otis's case. He showed up with a very good dog and pony show, and he was given optional probation, even though I knew that he was a tremendous threat to the community, and frankly, so did his attorney, but obviously his attorney had to advocate for him. He promptly failed probation and was sent to prison. But when you take, in those days, the 18-month sentence was subject to good time provisions, and when you take the county time that he'd already served away, he netted about a year in prison. And I saw that he's now, he reoffended again, which is no surprise. The reality is we don't fix most sex offenders. We just don't. We don't have the skills, and we don't have the capacity to supervise them adequately in our local communities. And frankly, 3194 isn't going to provide that kind of capacity. I apologize for not being sufficiently electronically savvy to have sent you the graphs that I wanted you to see, but I did bring this board with me, and I'd like to show it to you briefly, if I may. This board shows the average local jail capacity in the United States per 1,000 reported crimes. This is back in 2007. I'll tell you all the columns. The circumstance now is substantially worse in Oregon. 69 per thousand is the U.S. average, or was then. 62 per thousand was the Oregon average, which means that we're already about 11% below the national average. At the time we were having a discussion about funding jail beds in Lane County, we were at 8.5. Those beds were that we were debating were partially restored, and we ended up with about 14%. Where we stand today is about, as I testify, is about 10% of the, 10 beds per 1,000 reported crimes. I'm sorry I'm past my time, but I'll just say this. What this means in this context is we have nothing like the capacity we need to make something like 3194 work, and we're not going to have it with the small amount of money that would be allowed to Lane County. These best practices analysis assume something like normal USA conditions. We have nothing like that in Lane County, and there are many other jurisdictions in Oregon for which that is true. So we're going to get this burden, as we did under Senate Bill 1145, with nothing like the resources necessary to manage it. We'd have to use most of the money that Lane County would get just to bring our probation officer capacity up to the average. We're letting Measure 11 people go today without posting security because we have no jail. So this would be disastrous for Lane County. Bottom line, I can't speak to how severe it would be in other jurisdictions, but I can't imagine getting these sex offenders with nobody to supervise them. And we're not going to have, we have over 100 offenders per PO today. It's horrific. They'll reoffend.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner.
Hello, I'm Janice Steisinger. Thank you, Representative Garrett and Chairman Garrett and members of the committee. I'm a little reluctant to come. These are never comfortable things to talk about. I wanted to tell you about my brother. My brother, I gave you some pictures. This is a picture of my brother. His name is Jerry Craig. We grew up in Arizona, and this is a picture also of my father and my brother and I together. I show you that as to give you perspective of the relationship over time that I had with my brother. I always looked up to him and admired him. He's a forestry man, skilled engineer, a member of the National Guard, a good man, a family man. Another picture, he hated having his picture taken, so we didn't have a lot, but I have pictures of our family together. And you can see that very much he was a family man. His children, these are his children, the ages of him when he died. I wanted to tell you briefly how he died. He was at a community gathering, and a woman came up to him and said, "I need some help. Can you please just take me out of here?" And apparently her alcoholic live-in boyfriend was after her. And eventually my brother took her to a restaurant close by. And, well, the guy followed him there, and he... my brother said, "You know, if you guys need to work your thing out, that's fine, I'll leave, you know." And he goes, "No, you go ahead and stay here, but you're going to be sorry." And he left, went home, and got a gun, and came back. And he waited in the restaurant parking lot, and there were witnesses all around. And my brother got up to leave, and he said, "I had the weirdest feeling." And he walked out, and the guy started firing on the girl. She dove underneath the car. And he turned the gun and shot my brother in the back. My brother dropped to the ground. He was paralyzed. There were witnesses all around. The police came. The guy put a gun to his own head, decided the police talked him out of it. You know, before that, he had put the gun to my brother's head and said he was going to finish him up because he's going to be crippled. Ended up, my brother lived another 2 weeks and hired an attorney for assault. And a blood clot got loose in his body, and he ended up he went into a coma. And it took, our family gathered around him, and for 3 days we gathered around him, and we tried to encourage him to try to make it whatever he could. I'm a nurse, and so I saw all around the room the x-rays of how that bullet went in his body and bounced around from organ to organ. It's amazing that he lived as long as he did for those 2 weeks. But we had to wait through 3 days of testing to the hospital could prove that every single cell in his brain was dead, that he was completely brain dead. There was nothing left before they turned off the life support. It was extremely painful. The guy that shot my brother, it was his first offense, his violent crime, and he got everybody in the community could to send in letters to the DA. It took well over a year for that trial to come forward, and it went from one attorney to the other, to the other, to the other. And I tried to keep in touch with them as best I could. It was plea bargained down. Apparently the, I'm sorry, do you want me to stop?
Can you just try and wrap it up quickly?
Okay,
I will.
We've
got a few more panels to go.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
It's very hard for me to convince this.
I know.
They plea bargained it down to where the guy was only going to get 2 years and the year out on probation was going to be part of it. And so to our family, that was the extent of the justice, that my brother's life was only worth 1 year of this other man's life. And when the people of the community are looking for justice, if a community is going to say civil, it needs to have justice in it. And that's not justice. I went to, after, they ended up bringing out the fact that there was a dangerous nature involved with the act, and that the assailant of my brother had gone home and got a gun, and there were witnesses. The witnesses were listed on the back of the report, and they were never entered into the a grand jury trial. So he was, a bunch of mistakes happened, and none of the evidence was brought forward in the trial. So they ended up just plea bargaining it down to 2 years. They did bring it back up to where he was going to have to serve 10 because of some mandatory requirements for a dangerous nature. But they counted the year against that he served on probation, bail as part of his term served.
Janice, I'm awfully sorry, but we're going to have to...
Well, if I could just tell you about the watch real briefly.
Okay.
After the trial was over, the attorney and the judge were telling me what a good job they had done on everything. And I was watching them, I just listened to them, and the guy was using his hands a lot as he talked. And he had a beautiful watch on. And it really, to me, I just thought, time, 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 that's all it is. And I didn't know the watch, what it meant. But he noticed that I was watching his watch, and the sheriff that had forgotten to put all this information out got this shocked look on his face, and he took the watch off quickly and handed it to me, and he says, "I've been meaning to give you this. This was your brother's watch, and this was a year later. I just kept it for you." And he had been wearing it, and it had been his time. So justice is so important. And I worked hard on Measure 11 to pass it. Don't take away the effects of Measure 11.
Thank you for being here. Any questions? Sarah Brzezinski.
Janice, I'm sorry I didn't hear. What county was this in?
This was in Arizona.
In Arizona?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for coming and sharing your story.
All right. Thank you, panel. Michael Gullhouse, Andy Smith, and Rachel Post. I'm going to ask people to please, please adhere to the time limits. We have a few more panels, and we're already over time. So I don't want to cut anybody off mid-sentence, but we've got to move things along.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Andy Smith, and I'm testifying today as a co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. On Wednesday, you heard from a few other members from HISCO, and you might ask why I'm here again today. Simply put, this is a very important bill whose time has come for Oregon. Although it's hard to believe, this is an occasion when Oregon can actually learn something from the otherwise dysfunctional politics of our nation's capital. Just a few weeks ago, two people who have never been able to agree on anything came to agreement on the basic issue before you today. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky and Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont have jointly introduced a bill that gives judges more discretion on mandatory minimum sentences. The Justice Safety Valve Act of 2013 is intended to prevent unjust and irrational criminal punishments, according to the text of the measure. Senator Leahy, and this was just 2 weeks ago, Senator Leahy commented, "As a former prosecutor, I understand that criminals must be held accountable. Our reliance on mandatory minimums has been a great mistake. I am not convinced that it has reduced crime. It is time for us to let judges go back to acting as judges and making decisions based on the individual facts before them." Senator Paul remarked that mandatory minimum laws reflect a Washington knows best, one-size-fits-all approach, which undermines the constitutional separation of powers, violates the bedrock principle that people should be treated as individuals, and costs the taxpayers money without making them any safer. Across the country, this bipartisan consensus on needed reforms in public safety approaches is remarkable. According to a key leader from the Lone Star State in Texas, who said, "In Texas, we had been repeatedly expanding our prisons without seeing an improvement in our crime rate compared to other states. After looking at years of research, we found that focusing prison space on violent and career criminals and directing funds to proven alternatives for lower-level offenders would yield greater results for public safety." In Ohio, Governor John Kasich made criminal justice reform a priority of his administration in 2011. Upon signing the bill, he said, "I get emotional about this because I think passage of this bill is going to result in the saving of many, many lives, maybe even thousands before it's all said and done. I think, as we all know, this type of reform and legislation has sat idle for 25 years. Nobody wanted to touch it, but they did." In Oklahoma, Governor Fallon said, who passed similar measures, "In addition to saving tax dollars, community sentencing options will help nonviolent offenders, many of whom have been substance abuse problems, to receive treatment and safety and to get safely back into their communities." This also happened in Virginia. In Florida, Jeb Bush noted, "States across the country, including Florida, are proving that policies based on these sound conservative principles will reduce crime and its cost to taxpayers." So what can Oregon learn from our nation's capital and from all of these states? A positive vote on House Bill 7094 is a vote for a safer Oregon. It's a vote for fewer victims. It's a vote for fewer broken lives and sound budget policy. It's a vote for the principle that the data and evidence matters over politics. Thank you. I hope you'll support House Bill 3194.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Michael Galhouse, and I'm a program manager at CASA of Oregon, a nonprofit focused on providing affordable homes and building assets for Oregonians in need. I'm here today to testify in support of the Oregon Public Safety Passage, House Bill 3194. House Bill 3194 is important to CASA of Oregon because we believe the communities we serve and live in should have an effective and efficient public safety system. While we recognize the progress that has been made, we are concerned by cuts in services and escalating costs that will draw scarce resources away from the investments that Oregonians need. We also see opportunities from a more balanced approach which adopts policy innovations that hold offenders accountable while improving services for victims, as well as the rehabilitation of people who commit crimes. The Oregon Commission on Public Safety identified $600 million in additional correction costs over the next decade that will result from our current trajectory. This is on top of the present $1.3 billion cost per biennium, at a time when we are laying off teachers and cutting funds for addiction and mental health treatment. We are also concerned that funding for community corrections and law enforcement has been decimated during the past decade. By using our tax dollars more effectively, we can prevent crime instead of building more prisons to house another 2,300 inmates at the public's expense. HB 3194 is an important step in realigning our priorities. Over the summer, I had the privilege of touring the Coffee Creek facility in Wilsonville. While there, I was troubled to learn that classrooms were occasionally being converted to temporary prison cells due to a lack of bed capacity. This interfered with the ability to provide training and instruction to inmates who have a desire to learn and rehabilitate themselves. The staff observed that current trends they attributed to Measures 11 and 57 were expected to exacerbate this problem. I urge the committee to move HB 3194 forward so that these modest reforms can improve our public safety system while providing cost savings that all Oregonians will benefit from. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Post. I'm the public policy advisor at Central City Concern in Portland. Central City provides comprehensive solutions to homelessness and promotes self-sufficiency to approximately 13,000 individuals and families each year. I'm here today to convey CCC's support of the Oregon Public Safety Package, House Bill 3194, including sentencing reform and the reinvestment in crime prevention services like treatment. House Bill 3194 is important to my organization because we support and operate evidence-based practice programming that assists thousands of people from all over the state of Oregon to overcome hardships, succeed in their mental health and substance use treatment, and recover their lives so they can reunite with their families and contribute productively to their communities. Some of our programs assist individuals exiting incarceration, become responsible taxpayers, and pay restitution for the crimes they've committed. As a result of one of our programs, a 2008 independent study conducted by Portland State University found that participants in our outpatient treatment combined with clean and sober supported housing experienced a 95% reduction in their drug use and a 93% reduction in criminal activity. Another program in partnership with Southeast Works and funded by the Department of Labor reduced recidivism over a five-year period by 11% and was recognized as one of the top performing projects in the country. Finally, another program in partnership with Volunteers of America in Portland serving chronic offenders in the city of Portland reduced recidivism by 91%. The 87 graduates represent a collective total of 870 years of incarceration with an estimated cost savings of over $45 million in jail beds alone. In real-life terms, I've had the privilege of witnessing the transformation that occurs in these programs. In the 12 years I've worked at Central City Concern, I've witnessed formerly incarcerated individuals successfully complete substance use treatment, hold their drug-free newborn babies, regain custody of children placed into the foster care system, become employed, and on occasion purchase their own homes. We need to get smart on crime by reinvesting a portion of correction savings generated by reforms into evidence-based victim services, community corrections, addictions, and mental health treatment and reentry programs. Ensuring that we have a strong public safety system is a part of creating a safe and strong community we all want to live in. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. Again, I ask your support for House Bill 3194, and I urge the committee to move this package forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just one brief one. So were most of those federal mandatory minimums, was that on the drug violations?
Representative Barker, you know, I'm not sure of the correct answer to that question.
Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Paige Clarkson, Sheila Nielsen, and Cheryl Ramirez, please. And then the folks after that, just so you're ready, will be Shanika Torres, Jackie Altamirano, and Tony Funches.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, and co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Paige Clarkson. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County, and I'm here on behalf of my office as well as with the support of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Generally in opposition of 3194, but specifically with regard to removing assault to robbery two from ballot measure 11. I'm here with Sheila Nielsen, who is a survivor of domestic violence, and I want to tell you her story briefly and let her speak to you. But before I do that, I just want to point out very briefly, as I've listened to some of the testimony this afternoon, I just want to point out that there is an opt-out provision for the charges of assault 2 and robbery 2 under statute. It's ORS 137712. This already exists in the statute, allowing for a reduction of sentences out of ballot measure 11 for those two offenses. So removing it from ballot measure 11 is not necessary. Judges already have the discretion under those statutory provisions to address those issues. So with that being said, I do want to talk to you about Sheila Nielsen's case. On May 31st of 2006, when Sheila Nielsen arrived at the Salem Hospital emergency room, she was incoherent. She had multiple significant injuries. She was so severely bruised, literally from head to toe, that the attending ER physician could not determine her ethnicity. She had hemorrhaging and swelling of the brain such that the doctors thought she would have permanent brain damage. In fact, she suffered a midline shift of her brain inside of her skull. She had broken ribs and orbital fractures to her face. The doctor noted in her chart that the injuries were a result of what he quoted as a systematic beating, virtually leaving no part of her body untouched and unbruised. An investigation determined shortly after that that what preceded her arrival at the emergency room that day was a 9-day violent siege at the hands of her husband and father of her 3 small children. Most of the time, those children were in the home during that battering offense. Her husband, Mark Nielsen, had no criminal history to speak of prior to this. Mark Nielsen hit her with his fist repeatedly over those 9 days, kicked her repeatedly, called her vile names, stood on her chest with the full force of his weight so that she could not breathe, forced her to sleep outside on the floor of the shed next to the family dog, because that's what he thought she deserved. I prosecuted him for assault, too, along with other offenses, kidnapping and unlawful use of a weapon for holding a gun to her head. And he pled guilty to numerous offenses and received 33 years in prison. Over half of that sentence, 17 and a half years, was due to an assault to ballot measure 11 charges, 3 of them that were run consecutively by the Honorable Judge Thomas Hart here in Marion County. Mark Nielsen deserved every single one of those days that he received for that assault. And I want Ms. Nielsen to have an opportunity to talk to you about that now and let you know what the effect of those charges had on her. Ballot Measure 11 and Assault 2 was an essential portion of those charges and his eventual sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Sheila Nielsen. Thank you for this opportunity. And I'm sitting here opposing ballot measure 11, and the reason, it's amazing how I remember when it went into effect, my life was fine, I don't do anything wrong, typically, well, you know, I think you know what I mean, until you're in the middle of a situation where it's amazing how you feel safe now that you know that your husband or ex-husband is behind bars and cannot have any impact on your life now. When that happened, the kids were 8, 7, and baby was like 18 months. And for us to be able to live without fear today and know that they will be grown and adults when he has the opportunity to get out is such a huge relief to me. I still fear because his family supported him throughout this whole entire time. I have zero contact with his family out of fear because of their support for their son. I don't believe he justified what he did because it was my fault. I believe to this day he still does not accept responsibility for what he did. He continues to point fingers at anybody accepting the blame for what he did. So for him to get a lighter sentence, go into rehab, whatever's needed, I don't believe that would work because you first have to accept the fact that you did something wrong and not keep blaming others. So I really oppose the reform of this measure. I believe it. You have a choice in your life of what you do. And he chose to do that. He chose to continue every day for a total of 9 days until I was literally unconscious. And my son drove me to the hospital, who was 15. So I fully support this and oppose this measure.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez, director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, which represents CMHP directors and health and human service directors that are county-based across the state. Because of the time limitation, I'm just going to offer you 5 bullet points for your consideration in making a decision on the bill. While AOCMHP, our association, is not taking a position on House Bill 3194, we strongly support increased funding of appropriate treatment alternatives for people with mental illness and addictions, as well as investment in specialty courts and other jail diversion programs, community corrections, law enforcement training, and victim services. So my first point is that, according to national statistics, about 60% of individuals with incarcerated in jails and prisons have a substance use problem, and a big portion of those have a co-occurring mental illness. About 20% of individuals who are incarcerated have a serious mental illness. We would submit that that is not the best place for them to be treated for those problems. Second, jail diversion is cost effective. In a recent study in Washington State, of low-income childless adults, 30% of whom had recent jail involvement, they found that chemical dependency treatment lowered the rearrest rate by 21 to 33%. They found a $5,000 to $10,000 savings for each person treated, among other results. Third, assuming that we'll have Medicaid expansion in Oregon, 45% of the individuals incarcerated will be newly eligible for Medicaid and have a behavioral health program. So given our coordinated care organization system, they should receive better care in the community, more prevention, more early intervention, which would mean they would be less of a burden on jails and prisons, and hopefully then there would be more beds available for others who committed serious crimes. My fourth point is that OHA convened a work group that was comprised of law enforcement and mental health professionals who came up with recommendations for alternatives to arrest and incarceration for people with serious mental illness and addictions, which included a variety of crisis services that are needed in the community, transition services, peer services, and jail diversion services. And then fifth, concerning the U.S. DOJ settlement agreement obligations, as you may know, under the settlement agreement, Oregon must decrease involvement of individuals with serious and persistent mental illness in the criminal justice system. So there are four specific points that I have in your written testimony that I won't go into because I'm about at time. But please consider those as well. Thank you for the...
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Being able to testify.
Thank you, panel. So coming up now is Shanika Torres, Jackie Altamirano, and Tony Funchess. And following them will be Ann Pratt and Jane Furlich.
Co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jacqueline Altamirano, and I'm here to testify today in support of Oregon's public safety package, HB 3194. I'm a student at Portland State University and co-chair of Oregon Dreamers. HB 3194 is important to me because as a student and a community member, I support efforts to update and improve Oregon's public safety system. Oregon can balance holding people who commit crimes accountable and maintaining a high level of public safety with increased efficiencies in the criminal justice system. Improving the public safety system by emphasizing lower cost and more effective policies will allow for reinvestment of public safety dollars to improve services for victims, increase community corrections and other public safety efforts, and invest in rehabilitation through increased access to services such as drug treatment. HB 3194 has a right balance of ensuring that people who commit a crime are held accountable for their actions, and once atoned, prioritizes helping them move forward and making a positive contribution to society. We need to get smart on crime by reinvesting in services that would help the community. The modest proposals developed by the Governor's Commission on Public Safety can prevent 2,300 additional prison beds and save over $600 million in the next 10 years. $600 million that we could reinvest in other areas that are extremely important to Oregonians, such as a better-funded educational system. Lastly, as a youth of color, I'm concerned that Measure 11 has been proven to impact youth of color disproportionately. Research on Measure 11 has shown that black youth are unnecessarily being thrown into an adult court and being overcharged for lower-level offenses. Latino youth are most likely to be convicted for their original charge, which suggests that there may be a serious problem with lack of access to culturally competent legal help and court proceedings. Measure 11 is a bad policy, and these modest reforms will help bring greater balance to our system, particularly for youth of color. We need to pass 3194. I ask you to support HB 3194 and urge the committee to move this package forward. Thank you for your time and for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tony Funches, and I'm a student at Portland Community College. Currently, there are over 10,000 adults under the jurisdiction of the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice Adult Service Division, and I am one of them. I was released from prison on August 28, 2010, and immediately placed on post-prison supervision by the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. In 1989, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision supervised only 2,000 Oregonians, but by 2009, that number had grown to over 14,000. 95% of the individuals who are incarcerated are coming home. One day they will be returning home to our communities. I am here today to support House Bill 3194 because that bill is about Oregon's future. This bill does not change anything for people that are currently in the system. House Bill 3194 doesn't let anyone out. This bill is about lowering recidivism rates and improving community programs like the ones I had access to. When we view community justice as a whole, we must remember the community part. There are community programs and community leaders who want to join in the process to help make our community safe and whole. Individuals who are removed from the community through the corrections process do return. It is the community that must partner with correction entities to help ensure a safe, positive, productive reentry and transition. When dollars are given to programs that help prevent incarceration, like access to higher education, drug and alcohol treatment, specialty courts, there is an exponential return on those dollars. This return is much greater than the one seen by simply incarcerating people. There is a restorative power that only community support can give to an individual who has been through the criminal justice system. When I came home, I had no hope. I was on parole. I was a felon. I was unemployable, unable to obtain housing, and felt utterly unloved. However, through the support of my family and friends and the community, faith-based organizations, Portland Community College, and Better People and other community programs, I was able to find hope again. Furthermore, the achievements that I have accomplished are my community's achievements as well. Since returning home and enrolling in Portland Community College, I have been on the honor roll for 9 times. 5 times on the president's list, and 3 times most consecutively for a 4.0. I am president of the Black Student Union, student coordinator of an access program, and a peer mentor for our federally funded TRIO Roots program. None of this would have been possible without community programs being in place to help support my transition and reentry. Without the involvement of community, I would have probably followed the route of so many other individuals and been reincarcerated. However, there was an investment made in me by my community, and by the access and the availability of community programs and community college, I will be successfully completing my term on post-prison supervision. May 21st of this year, my supervision ends. Where I stand today in giving this testimony speaks of the value of justice reinvestment. The dollars given to community programs, they pay back. They give back to you. So it is my ask that when you hear my name, Tony Funches, it is not as a felon, but as a success story and as a leader. And that is only made possible by community investment. I please ask you to pass House Bill 3194.
Thank you and congratulations.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, panel, very much.
Thank you for your time.
We have Ann Pratt and Jane Furlich coming up, and our next group will be David Leslie, Tom English, and Greg Hazarbedian.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Pratt, and I'm here representing Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm going to try and beat that.
Ann, if you could move a little bit further away from the mic, because we're getting feedback. Thank you.
Okay, sorry. Mothers Against Drunk Driving is opposed to House Bill 3194 because it significantly reduces incarceration periods for DUI offenders. Am I still too close?
Mm-hmm. Just back up another inch.
Yeah, you don't need to lean into it.
Okay.
Very sensitive.
Sorry.
That's okay.
That's good.
MAS specifically opposes reducing the mandatory Measure 11 sentence for DUI offenders who are convicted of assault 2 from 70 months to a 34 to 36 month presumptive sentence. MAD favors confinement, which cannot be suspended or probated for those convicted of this violent crime. Making the sentence mandatory removes the uncertainty and increases the deterrent value of the sanction. MAD also specifically opposes increasing earn time for presumptive sentences from 30% from 20% to 30% of those who are convicted of a DUI and in the same incident, criminally negligent homicide, assault 3, or hit and run, and also felony DUI falls into that category. MAD opposes any type of reduction in sentences, early release, alternative incarceration programs as a substitute for appropriate traditional penalties and sanctions for drunk and drug drivers driving crimes. Orion has been a national leader in reducing the instances of DUI fatalities and serious injuries in the past decade. In 1998, when my son was killed by a drunk driver, Oregon had 280 DUI fatalities. We have cut that approximately in half. The drunk driver who killed my son only served 20 months for taking 50 to 60 years of my son's life. That was not justice. House Bill 3194 would release these dangerous criminals back into our communities early and possibly at our expense. According to NHTSA, the cost of just one additional DUI fatality is approximately $3.6 million. The cost of one additional serious injury is approximately $108,000, plus the lifelong emotional toll on the victims of these heart-wrenching crimes. As a victim and a victim advocate, and having sat in many courtrooms in several counties, I can tell you that the lives of these victims don't just go on after these events, and time does not heal all wounds. House Bill 3134 is not worth the risk of increasing recidivism and creating more victims of crime. Also, on the back of my testimony, I've listed some cases that I think some of you will recognize, and the victims are listed first. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being here. Jane?
Hi, my name is Jane Furlich, and I'm a crime victim from Tigard in Washington County. On July 18, 1999, my mother-in-law, Angela Furlich, thought she was going on a day trip out to the Oregon coast with her husband and 12-year-old granddaughter. Instead, she found herself embarking on a lifetime of pain, suffering, and anguish over the loss of her husband, her granddaughter, and her previous good health. On that July day, a repeat DUI offender crossed the center line of Highway 26 near the largest Sitka Spruce and plowed into their Honda Accord, killing 70-year-old Martin Furlich, 12-year-old Jennifer Furlich, and seriously injuring Angela Furlich. Angela was taken to Seaside Hospital and then life-flighted to Emanuel Hospital in Portland because her blood pressure was 60 over pulp, which means she didn't have one. She had a concussion, lacerated liver, broken arm, chest pain, lacerated face and shattered eye orbit, and multiple scrapes and bruises over her body. When I saw her in the ICU, I was thankful she survived, but I couldn't believe that this bandaged and broken woman was my beautiful mother-in-law. During her 3 weeks in the hospital, they also discovered she had a broken foot and then developed a staph infection. She started filling up with fluid in her lungs, so they inserted a chest tube. The surgeon, the infamous Dr. Patel. Because the focus was on her internal injuries, they didn't even realize her broken arm was mending crooked, and she also had a broken collarbone until weeks later. The doctors wanted to re-break her arm, but by that time she had had so much pain in surgery, she just cried, "No more, I can't take any more." Years later, she regretted that decision because her arm was weak, and when she tried to catch herself falling out of bed, she put her hand out and her wrist shattered. 6 years later, she still has a plate and pins to hold the bones in place, and her upper arm has a permanent bend in it, kind of like that. She still suffers from the effects of the crash. She has back problems and has had two additional surgeries, foot problems, vision problems, and falls often. She fell in her front yard 2 years ago and ended up in the ER with a skull fracture and concussion. Last Wednesday, she lost her balance, getting into her car, and fell and broke her kneecap. She wanted to be here today, but she is once again bedridden. The crash aged her about 20 years. These are just 2 years of her medical records. James Willie, previously convicted of manslaughter in 1979 of killing his wife and best friend while driving drunk, and then convicted of manslaughter times two for killing Martin and Jennifer, was also convicted of assault two for injuring Angela Furlich. It was a Measure 11 crime. If it was reduced to half that time, this repeat DUI offender would be out of prison today, ready to drive and maim again, while his victim remains in a prison of broken health, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and very bad survivor's guilt. She will never be released from her prison. Please do not reduce the prison time for the horrific crime of assault too. Please protect us from violent, drugged, and drunk drivers, because sometimes surviving is worse than dying. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
Ann and Jane. Our next group is David Leslie, Tom English, and Greg Hazarbedian. And the group following them will be Dee Dee Koontz and Ryan Jocelyn. Dee Dee. I guess Dee Dee's gone.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee, and other co-chairs. My name is David Leslie. I'm the Executive Director of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, which is a statewide Christian association of denominations, faith-based ministries, social ministries from all corners of the state. I'm here today on behalf of EMO in support of HB 3194. Foundational to our core values is a belief in the power of restorative justice, which holds that justice is best served when those impacted by crime, the victim, the perpetrator, and the broader community are given opportunities to constructively engage in the system itself. With this as a background, there are several aspects of HB 3194 that I want to lift up and support this afternoon. First, we believe that there needs to be equity in sentencing process that balances the role of judges and the sentencing power of district attorneys. Modification of mandatory minimum sentences for certain types of offenses, we believe, will lead to less reliance on the need for long-term jail and prison sentences, reducing stress on our state prison system. Likewise, we wholeheartedly support recommendations that allow for reduction in current sentences and participation in alternative incarceration programs if certain conditions are met, allowing for accelerated reintegration into and contributing to the betterment of society. Second, we also are supportive of the distinction this legislation makes between adolescents and adults in the sentencing phase. We support the elimination of the possibility of 15, 16, or 17-year-olds being charged as adults for certain crimes and earned review for youth offenders who have already served a majority of their sentence. We believe that these two changes recognize it's wrong to charge youth as adults, and that the cognitive and emotional development stages of youth are not the same as adults. We also believe that the stories of many young people in the criminal justice system can change from a narrative of crime and seemingly unending punishment to a narrative of redemption and rehabilitation. As such, this bill offers more possibility for some young people in the system to return to their communities more quickly and rebuild their lives in ways that will give them a productive stake in their future and society's future also. The third and last aspect of the bill I want to lift up this afternoon is related to the cost containments included in this legislation. Today, it's important that we take the opportunity to take steps to contain tomorrow's projected spending for new prison beds in existing or new jails and prisons. We support the Community Corrections Incentive Grant concept and cost containment solutions that reduce the operating cost of Oregon Department of Corrections over the next decade. Hopefully, if these costs are indeed recognized, we hope that they'll be reinvested in ways to reduce crime in the first place and the propensity for repeat offenses. We thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and we bring this today as a community organization that represents and has all people from all backgrounds in our pews every Sunday.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is the Reverend Thomas R. English, and I reside at 2530 Fairmont Boulevard in Eugene, Oregon. And I just want to take a second to officially bless you for your patience and your endurance on this matter. It's been wonderful. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Episcopal Diocese of Oregon, Commission on Jail and Prison Ministry, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon as our partner, and the Partnership for Safety and Justice. Honorable co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm here to support 3194. I'm a semi-retired criminal justice professional and I spent 35 years as a consultant with the U.S. Department of Justice, assisting jurisdictions around the country to use evidence-based practices in their own communities. We have a growing and robust body of research now that tells us what are the effective and smart things to do. I did receive a master's degree in corrections from the University of Oregon in 1972, and for the last 14 years, I've served as a chaplain in the Lane County Jail, for a shorter period for the Department of Corrections as a regional chaplain for Lane County in their Home for Good program. I serve on the department's Religious Services Advisory Council and as chairman of the board of Sponsors Incorporated, which is a community-based reentry program now celebrating its 40th anniversary. Clerics and churches are often viewed as idealistic, unrealistic, or even soft on crime. However, I do want you to know that the Christian church has historically always taken safety, crime, and punishment very seriously and continues to do so today. Without order, the church cannot function. And it's just this concern for order in which we have been complicit in some of the distortions of justice that have caused so much harm today. We, the church, are called to confess that its members fall short in responding to crime, its harms, and the justice system. Often we've been complacent and complicit or allowed fear or hatred of the stranger to dictate our responses to crime. We have allowed the crimes and the harm to go unheard. We have allowed the burdens of crime and the criminal justice system to be unfairly borne. In confessing its complicity, the church recognizes that it's gone awry. This church invokes the judgment of God's guidance, and with God's guidance, we ask for the council that its ministers might better and more mercifully serve those harmed by the injustice and turn us into the advocates for renewed work. The criminal justice system in Oregon has already been talked about as being broken and gone awry. We have the instruments and the research to make it new. Senate Bill 3194 does all of those things and can do it well. In your work session, you'll have the opportunity to make the adjustments that you need to make in order to make this a profitable experience for all of Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg,
you need the microphone.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Garrett, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Greg Hazarabedian. I have been a criminal defense lawyer for over 20 years and have served for the past 8.5 years as executive director of the Public Defender's Office in Lane County. I am also privileged to serve on the Governor's Corrections Forecast Advisory Committee and the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Today I speak to you on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon, where I serve on the Legislative Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today in support of HB 3194. People who commit a crime need to be held accountable for their actions. Once they have been, they must have the tools to move forward, better their lives, and make a positive contribution to society. The ACLU believes that public defenders have an important and unique role to play in this dynamic. The role of the public defender is not just to defend the constitutional and statutory rights of the accused or to provide the constitutional requirement of the right to counsel. We do that and more. We have also gained great knowledge of the gaps in the resources needed by our clients. No one is in favor of crime in our communities, and we as public defenders are no exception. We are invested in the success of our clients, both for their own lives and that of their families, as well as for the safety of the communities we all live in. We are taxpayers with families just like you. Our work doesn't involve just defending the rights or beating a charge, but we uncover the history of our clients, their addictions to drugs or struggles with mental illness. We help develop plans for their success that involve the resources they need to succeed, whether they are sentenced to probation or prison or are re-entering society after prison. We work with others across the system to make sure that the right resources are directed to the right people. Prison is our most expensive and in many cases our least effective tool for public safety. And our work shows us that there are many who could best be held accountable in other ways, which would do more to increase public safety in Oregon. As a public defender, I have seen our local public safety infrastructure dwindle. Cuts to community corrections, addiction and mental health treatment programs have not only made our job harder, it has made our clients' pathway to success that much more difficult. It is in this context today that I speak to you in support of HB 3194. Our public safety system is in need of much greater reforms than are proposed in this bill, but these modest improvements are a good first step. Adjustments to mandatory minimum sentences ensure the availability of just and fiscally responsible sentencing options. Guideline sentencing allows judges to account for criminal history and repeat offender status at sentencing more effectively than one-size-fits-all mandatory minimum sentencing schemes, ensuring that serious criminal conduct is more heavily punished than less serious conduct. Giving judges back their discretion would allow them to be sensitive to the circumstances of each crime and the defendant involved.
Can you conclude, please?
I urge your support, and unless you have any questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. All three of you, any questions? We appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much being here. Colleagues, we're getting near the end. I believe we have one more witness to testify against the bill. That's Ryan Joslin. Come forward now. And then we have 8 or 9 final folks to testify in favor. So that's where we stand. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Ryan Joslin. I'm the Grant County District Attorney. I've been an attorney for 16 years, 9 of which were as a defense attorney, amongst other things, as a private practice. The last 7 years I've been the Grant County District Attorney. I grew up just across the river in Monmouth, Oregon, met a Grant County girl, moved back to Grant County, to God's country, and there raised my 6 children with her. I'm opposed to House Bill 3194, in particular, the changes proposed to ballot measure 11. First of all, I'd like to say I fully endorse the comments of my fellow prosecutors, and for the record, I don't think Ms. Suver looks a day over 25. Grant County in particular voted in strong support of ballot measure 11. I don't know what the actual numbers are, but whatever the percentages were throughout the rest of the state of Oregon, I think you had about 10% to 20% on top of that, and that was a Grant County's position. But I think throughout the state of Oregon, the ballot measure 11 was strongly supported, and I think it continues to have strong support. I think as you folks consider possible changes, in particular ballot measure or a House Bill 3194. I think we're ignoring the reality that, frankly, any changes proposed or even accomplished through this group aren't going to be tolerated by this by the voters of the state of Oregon. I think ultimately, on paper at least, initially it looks like a cost-saving matter, but ultimately I think it's going to ultimately result in additional cost to us. I can my daughter's an English major, going to be a teacher. She's a junior in college right now, and we talk books and that. And the example of the Greek mythological character, the Hydra, comes to mind with the many heads. As you cut one off, two grow back. And I think if you make changes to ballot measure 11, again, there's going to be a law that's proposed to come back and fill those gaps. And I think it's going to be broader and further reaching than what we're dealing with now. That ultimately will result in additional costs. I know as a prosecutor, I've dealt with many cases that ballot measure 11 mandatory minimums were insufficient, particularly in regard to sex abuse cases. And I've had judges agree with me and impose consecutive sentences. But many times, again, those are just not sufficient. I know there's misdemeanor cases. One in particular I can think of just recently, a sex abuse case, 15-year-old boy sexually molested by a 67-year-old man. That's been a very traumatizing experience to that young man. He's been engaging in cutting behavior, considering suicide. And frankly, that's a case I feel like ought to appropriately be a mandatory minimum sentence, and I think many voters will agree with me. So I just urge you, as you consider what to do and what not to do, to steer wide around changes to 3194, because I think they're going to come back to bite us, and I don't think it's going to ultimately save costs. So I'd ask you not to do that. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. Any questions?
No. All
right. Thanks again. Our next panel is Sharon Maxwell Hendricks, Curtis Bear Cub, and Kay Turan, please. Please go ahead. I'm just going to step out for a minute.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Curtis Bearcup. I'm a member of Phoenix Rising Transitions and a leader with the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, MACG, if you will. Phoenix is a community-based mentor project working with people before and after release from prison. Phoenix is also a member of MACG, a group of churches, synagogues, unions, and nonprofits working together for positive change in Portland. My participation in MACG started when I took Phoenix's leadership class at Columbia River Correctional Institution just a little over a year ago. MACG members came into the prison to help with the training. This set me on a new path, much different than any I'd taken in the past. Before, I couldn't quite get it right. At least that's how it looked to me. Believe it or not, my in-laws used to bet on how quickly I'd go back to jail. Their denigration of me made me feel worthless. But this time I had prepared for something different. I took Phoenix's leadership and nonviolent communication classes and met and chose my Phoenix mentors a year before I came home. During that year, we worked together twice a week, learning community organizing and communication skills. These new skills and relationships actually helped me to identify key components of my own transition. With an intention I'd never before employed, I went about achieving my goals. I'm reconnecting with my kids, going to college, got a job. People were betting on me now. I'd tell them to bet on the new Curtis Bearcup, staying out of prison and working towards good things in my community. That's your community as well. I started volunteering with MACG's Prison and Community Action Team last fall. I recognized some people who had come into the prison to teach. It was great to connect with them again, this time as a community member. On the action team, former prisoners and other citizens worked together to identify our shared interests and concerns about public safety. We saw that we're underfunded. Since mentoring has been important in my own transformation, I wanted to act as well. I came to Salem last fall to a sentencing commission hearing, and here I am again today as a MACG leader, urging you to invest public safety dollars on programs that really do make a difference.
I know firsthand the powers of these programs to change lives and make our communities safer in ways that prison can. Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good supports House Bill 3194, and we urge your support as well. I want to thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, chairs and the committee. I'm Sharon Maxwell Hendricks. I am a small business owner. I'm a parent. I'm an activated community member, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3194. Whereas I don't have anything typed up because I got the information at the last moment, but I do want to speak from my own personal experience as well as being able to talk to you about promising practices that I have not heard here mentioned today. And what I'd like to say is just ditto to every supporter that has already gone before me, because I know the time is short. But the main thing is that community organizations, faith-based ministries do work, reinvesting in training, education that is successful for our young people. No young person under the age of 18 or 25 wakes up on any given morning and says, I want to go out and commit a crime so that I can spend time in Oregon Youth Authority or Oregon State Penitentiary. What we have seen here is a lot of discriminatory practices, a lot of unsuccessful people that have not benefited from our economy here in Oregon. And as a small business owner, that was part of my vision and passion 30 years ago when crack cocaine hit our neighborhood and ravaged it and tore up our middle-class families, devastated our community. Basically, we were left without an economy within the North Northeast Portland, leaving our young people and a lot of teenage parents to really fend for themselves, okay? So we want to see the reinvestment. This House Bill 3194, it does work. As a small business owner, I hire people local from the community. Because of the gang violence, my son 3 years ago was charged with 5 Measure 11s, over 21 counts. He's now serving time in the Oregon Youth Authority. Had I not been there to advocate for him, basically he would be serving those mandatory sentencing, okay? My child raised him up in the church, good family, good support system, but he thought he was missing something because his friends didn't have the support from their parents and people to let them know that they have value and that they have the ability to contribute to society in a positive way. But I know that the reinvestment and our young people and people returning to the community, like Tony Fuches just said, it does work. I actually created a nonprofit, which is Y2ABC, Youth and Young Adult Being Connected, to provide summer work programs for the last 5 years, collaborating and partnering with the City of Portland and other entities. So I know my time is up, but reinvestment does work. If we invest in human capital, the human capital will pay off. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rand.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. I am Kate Turan, President and CEO of Volunteers of America, Oregon. I'm here, we are a broad-based human service organization that has a large division that works with treatment and recovery. Included in our social services portfolio, we administer several programs that focus on the high-risk population in our community. These are individuals who have some criminal involvement in their lives and have been convicted of a crime. I'm here to testify in full support of the Oregon Public Safety Package, HB 3194, both the sentencing reform and the reinvestment in alternative programs. HB 3194 is important to my organization because we support efforts to transform Oregon's public safety system. We do so because our programs that use evidence-based practices have been able to demonstrate the effective methods of working with this high-risk population and achieving stellar results. We believe because we have demonstrated that it's possible to hold people who have committed crimes accountable while maintaining a high level of public safety, while increased efficiencies in the criminal, level of public safety with increased efficiencies in the criminal justice system. Volunteers of America Oregon encourages you to pass a bill that reinvests in those alternative programs, including mental health and substance abuse treatment. As examples, Volunteers of America Oregon has two such programs I want to describe to you here this afternoon that are part of our treatment and public safety divisions. In collaboration and partnerships with other community-based programs, we have demonstrated that it's doable to keep public safety as a high community goal, to ensure accountability, and to support the high-risk populations becoming successful, productive individuals within our community. Our first program, Community Partners Reinvestment, we call CPR, offers comprehensive, coordinated reentry support for the highest risk of young male offenders 18 through 25 returning from prison to the community. A five-year independent evaluation conducted by Portland State University indicated that 75% of the population that we were serving were not reconvicted of a new felony. 61% were either employed or attending school at the six-month follow-up. This resulted in an estimated cost savings of more than $1.35 million for this group of 58 young men based on the median cost of $6,100 per CPR participant. CPR has achieved similar outcomes with nearly 500 individuals since 2005. CPR has also been replicated locally to treat young men in the jail population in Multnomah County. Multnomah County Sheriff's Office data shows an average of half as many days in jail the year participants are in the program than the year prior. They reported savings for the first year of the program, a total of $418,000, which served 31 men. Our services include comprehensive coordinated reentry support, pre- and post-relief services, cognitive behavioral therapy, substance abuse treatment, and many other culturally competent programs that we know that work. There's another program I was going to also refer to. It's the REC program. You heard earlier testimony about that program, and the recidivism rate is also considerably lower as compared to the population of individuals who come out of the Department of Corrections. I encourage you to seriously consider all the testimony that you've heard today, and I thank you for your patience and staying late to hear this. But I do encourage you to support HB 3194. It's time for Oregon to be a leader in transformation of our public safety system.
Thank you, and we appreciate everybody else's patience for staying all afternoon to have their chance to be heard. So, any questions, Senator Prezansky?
Mr. Chair, just a statement. You stated earlier that you didn't get to prepare written testimony. Don't feel like you can't. If you want to take some time and get it to us, the committee still
open?
Yes, I am
going to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. All right. Thank you all very much. We appreciate your testimony. Second to last group is Brian Judd, Joey Johns, Mary Graham.
Thank you all for having me here. My name is Brian Judd. I'm here on behalf of Bridges to Change. I'm a mentor for them in Clackamas County. First of all, I'd like to applaud the hard work that it takes to identify any resources in this economic climate, especially with public safety, and your effort to direct them to aftercare and rehabilitation programs that I'm a part of in Clackamas County. My experience has been when I see gentlemen come out of prison and they have a relationship with simply a PO, it takes an extreme amount of motivation and personal willingness to make that work and to not recidivate. When we're able to provide them with a mentor, help them get a sponsor, help them have a house manager and clean and sober housing, and navigate them through the system to help them get identification, job opportunities, stay clean and sober, reunite them with their families, and build a relationship with their supervisor, they're wrapped up where if they just have a little bit of willingness, we're able to guide them through and help them make changes. When they go through the prison system, sentencing, I'm not here to speak on that, but when they have the willingness from either earning a little good time or earning the opportunity to participate in programs like AIP, a lot of that brings people out with a discipline that we're able to reinforce and give them some immediate positive consequences that they're able to see and hopefully grab onto and realize that they can make some changes in their life that is willing to keep them out of prison and from reoffending. Our numbers in Clackamas County show that since our program's been involved out there, we do make a difference. They're going in the right direction, and I really appreciate the efforts of this committee to find any resources. I know the sentencing with Measure 11 and 57 are politically hot and sensitive subjects. There's a lot of compromise involved there, and it's a real important investment in any resources you guys can find to put towards these programs that help us support people and help them not recidivate, because it's not just the crimes that I no longer commit, but it's the crimes that they no longer commit, the families that are no longer broken, and it's immeasurable the amount of savings that comes out of the very small investment in our programs. So I'm going to beat the green light for the first time today. Thank you.
Nicely done. We appreciate it.
All right, so my name is Joey Johns. I'm the program manager for the Bridges of Change program out of Multnomah County. I work with the REC program with Volunteers of America and Multnomah County Corrections. Mainly the program I work with are the AIP programs, alternative sanctions coming out of the prison system. What I see out of that is I see tremendous success in the prison system as far as alternative sanctions. Most of the guys coming out on transitional leave, the sentence they're getting cut off from after going through New Directions or Turning Point or the various other treatment programs from there, our stats are in the high 80s to 90s success from recidivism rates of them completing the program and us working with them. With the ongoing outpatient treatment that they receive, wraparound services, employment, and all the other things out there, they become family members, they get jobs, start businesses, become proper productive members of society. What's important to that with me is I work with a lot of these gentlemen and have for a great many years, but for probably 15 years of my life before I started doing that, I was an active drug user, convict many times over. I've been in the prison system my whole life. Before that, I was involved in gangs for a long time. What saved my life and what changed my direction in life was nonprofit programs. I went through the drug court program in Clackamas County, went through Bridges of Change in Clackamas County, and from there, my journey started in a positive direction. Without transitional services, without any of that before the times when I got out of prison, I reverted right back to what I always knew how to do, which was reoffend, commit property crimes because of drug abuse, which I see, probably 80 to 90% of the people I associate with in the prison system, that's what the problem is drugs and alcohol. With proper treatment, with proper reintegrated services upon their release, they can become successful, they can get off drugs, they can quit committing crimes, and I'm going to beat the green light also and stop there. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Mary Graham. I'm also a employee of Bridges to Change. And I just want to share my experience on, I'm also a widow. So when my husband was released from the penitentiary in 2003 and he did not get any transitional services and was thrown out to society, he didn't make it and it ended in his death. I witnessed the community being affected, me being affected, the law enforcement being affected, and generations, my children and my grandchildren. I have learned in my own recovery, I have the labels of convict, felon, and all that too. I've learned in my own recovery to take the bad and make it into the good. So I have been working for Bridges to Change as a house manager for 2 years. I live with these women day and night. I get up, I go to sleep, I watch, and I've gone through, over 100 women, and I watch them change. I watch them blossom with the support that Bridges to Change has done. I'm a newly hired mentor, so more will be revealed on that. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for being here. Appreciate all three of you. Thank you very much. I guess this is our final group. Dwayne Graves, Robert Ball, and Crystal Cooper.
Chris, see if there's anyone else.
And if there's anyone else here who did not sign up but would like to be heard, now is the time.
Hello, my name is Dwayne Graves, and I'm actually I live here in Salem, Oregon, and I'm here to testify in support of the H Bill 3194 as well. I'm bringing a little bit of different perspective. I'm bringing the perspective of a person that has used these programs and benefited from them. I started using drugs back in 1969 and have fought that addiction my whole life. So, of course, I've been in jails, been in prison twice. First time I went to prison, what I learned there was how to be a better criminal. So I came out, didn't have any programs and have any places to go, so I continued on with using drugs and doing crime. A few years later, then, of course, I was arrested again and was facing going back to prison again, and was pretty much just feeling down and out, like I didn't want to even live anymore. So what I had done is I remember that day for the rest of my life. I went over to buddies in my house. I'd been drinking all day. Went to his house I'd often gotten high with, and sure enough, he had some heroin there. So I decided, well, that, which is just what I need to make everything seem okay. So I did some. Now, for all you that may not know, you should never mix those two. You should never mix heroin and alcohol together. But I did. And as I fell onto the floor, I knew I was in trouble. My vision blurred and I couldn't talk. I felt my life ebbing away. Everything went dark and I was gone. But luckily, I didn't die that day. I woke up a few hours later and I did, in fact, go to prison. But this time when I went to prison, it was a little different because I went to an AIP program there, back to Summit program. And in there, I learned some tools and some cognitive things that helped me turn my life around. I learned the tools. I think one of the most important things for me in that program was when I got out. I was able to go to a clean and safe environment, a clean and sober house, a Bridges to Change house. So there I was able to get a job. I was able to start paying my fines back. I got my license. And so today I was actually blessed, and I now have run two of the houses for Bridges to Change here in Marion County. We have 24 beds here. And I drive daily now to Oregon City to a pilot project up there for Haven House, which is I'm a recovery mentor for folks with co-occurring disorders, folks that have substance abuse and Access One Mental. And I've been able to do all that because of these programs. And so I'm here in support of them, and I'm happy to say that my grandchildren have never seen me high because of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Robert Ball. I'm an ex-convict, and I just came here to support the 3194. I just got released from prison, and I've been in and out of prison for the last 25 years of my life. It just seems like once I get released, I get out, I have no place to go. So I do what I knew what to do, you know, criminal activity. This time when I got out of prison, I had Bridges to Change to go to. The very first time I had a residence to go to instead of the Salvation Army when the parole board would tell me to go to, or the mission downtown. And if you guys know those places, that's not a place where people are going to get better at. I mean, criminal activities are down there constantly. I got the opportunity to go to Bridges for Change because there was funding to pay for my rent there. And then I went from there to a pilot program called the SOARS program. I don't know if you guys have heard of it or not, but it's a very good program. It taught me the building skills and how to, not just the drug aspect and everything, to beat drugs, but the skills to go through life and to not go into my criminal behavior, because, you know, the path of least resistance is human nature. And to me, the path of least resistance was my criminal behavior. I mean, I'm out of prison now. You know, I might not have two nickels to rub together, but I'm okay with that now. I'm clean, I'm sober, and I'm okay with it. And the reason why I'm okay with it is because I had the opportunity not to get out and fight for survival. I had the opportunity to get out and go through these programs, and they taught me the skills that, you know, hey, listen, I don't have to have a pocket full of cash. You know, I'm okay with eating bologna sandwiches right now and living life. And I got to thank you guys for the funding that allowed me to do that. If you guys take that away, there's so many other people out there. It's obvious. They call me a slow learner. I'm a fast learner. Hey, I've been out since November, and I've learned this. You know, it took me 25 years in prison. Prison don't teach you anything except to be a better criminal. You know, I mean, there's sentences and everything, but they got to have funding to teach us when we get out. I mean, there's kids in there. You can't put a kitten in a lion cage and expect to take them out and not be a lion. You know, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that's a pretty good note to end on. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. All right. We have concluded our testimony.
Wait. Mr. Chair, there's one thing I do want to put on the record. Sorry that many of our colleagues aren't here. Mr. Kimmy, who was here for the Marion County Assistant District Attorney, gave us a case regarding the two juveniles and the very horrendous crime that they committed. I did not ask the question at the time, but I did ask him in the hall as to whether or not when they were sentenced by the judge, whether the judge was allowed for or did not allow for the ability for them to actually have second look, because that's what they were here for. He stated that the judge ruled against that and that they would not be able to be considered for any substantial or compelling reasons for having conditional release. So I think that needs to be on the record, because it appeared that they were using that as an example that maybe they were going to be entitled to that opportunity where they are not.
All right. Thank you, Senator. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3194. And no further business. Our meeting is adjourned. Thank you all for being here.